Good morning. Let me call the Board of Directors to order. First Lane County Public Utility District. It is August 20th, 2018, a few minutes past 10 a.m. And we have four commissioners present in the room and a fifth commissioner on the line. We encourage people to participate in our meetings in an orderly format. If you have a cell phone, please put that in a position that will not cause us to have to send it to a random address in Albuquerque. So with that being said, let's begin our meeting with our Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minutes by John Wisniewski. Thank you, John.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, commissioners. John Wisniewski, energy analyst with the Energy Planning and Trading Group. For today's safety note, I was going to talk about some back-to-school safety. School is starting, I believe, next Wednesday in the Wenatchee area. And with that, there'll be increased traffic of children on the roads, as well as the school buses will be running again. So according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, from 2006 to 2015, there were over 300 children killed in school transportation-related crashes. So a few safety notes with that in mind. In a school zone, when flashers are blinking, stop and yield to pedestrians and take extra caution when children are present. Never pass a vehicle that is stopped for pedestrians. When a school bus is stopped to load or unload children, never pass a bus from behind or from either direction if you're on an undivided road. And do not block a crosswalk when stopped at a red light or when waiting to make a turn, because this could push pedestrians out.
That's very appropriate. On my way here, I go right through a school zone, and for years I've been driving this route, and for years I've noticed that the little kids crossing the street couldn't care less that there's a 5,000-pound car bearing down on them. So, yes, so it's up to the drivers to really pay attention. Yeah. Yeah.
John, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Moving on to item two, approval of agenda. Any additions, corrections, movement in the agenda that the commission would like to see? Hearing none, the agenda will remain as presented. CPO, winner recognition. This is really cool. Thank you.
So this is a good one. Let me just take a second and introduce Josh Miller and John Barnett. Come on up, guys, and make yourself comfortable. This is our monthly cycle of personal ownership award winners. They did some work down at Rock Island focused on water supply both for potable water but also for keeping turbine units running cool. And I think that we were impressed with the level of accountability they took to make sure that things worked, even though and it was going to be a difficult time for the folks down there otherwise, because the weekend was coming up, some real challenges in terms of just being able to continue operations down there. But we also, our hearts are touched by the fact this comes out of the group that Eddie Gromley has been a part of, and noticing that it had to be a difficult time to take on a job like this. And so the combination of those two things, we really felt these guys stepped to the plate and displayed just the kind of values that we want to see around here. So take a moment and introduce them and let them talk a little bit about what they were working on and what they're doing.
Sure. I'm Josh Miller. This is John Barnett. We were down there making the cutover from the old tank to the new tank, and what needed to have happen was remove the controls from the pump in the old system, move them to the new system, move the alarm system over, verify all the telemetry in the new tank was correct. So it included climbing the tank, going inside the water tank, so it's tower climbing and confined space entry. So we had a team of technicians down there working so everybody could keep eyes on each other and keep safe. It definitely was a challenging job for two reasons. One, the week after we passed, and two, once you start, you can't stop this job. supply that drinking water. People have to have turbine cooling. We've got to keep the dam running. Even though it's a small part, you'd never really look left as you're going past the dam and see those tanks on the hill. Mm-hmm. But next time you're driving down there, take a peek. You'll see the water tanks up on the hill, the old one and the new one. So that's what we were up to that day, and about a 12-hour day. Pretty exciting.
The only other thing I could add was, along with doing the work, we're always more safety-oriented every day, and it seems like regulations are ever-changing. So this was also an opportunity for us to try some new procedures along confined space entry, because we actually had to go inside the water tank, and we didn't really have really good clarification in the past if we needed what type of gear we needed, because a lot of times you don't have to go in the tank to do the work, but you're right there on the threshold. So this is the first time that we're starting to get more in line with some of the confined space regulations, and we got to put up some new rescue retrieval gear. So there was a lot of staging of new equipment along with this job. It wasn't just getting the work done. We all knew how to do the work. It was new to also get to set up some safety equipment and, you know, start to change our culture a little bit. So.
I was going to ask the question, what type of safety equipment do you need when you go in a confined space like that? Is there any breathing apparatus or anything like that? Or
So we identify that there's a potential that inside a confined space that there could be some atmospheric concerns. So we definitely take an air monitor up there. And before we actually go into any of the confined spaces, we put the air monitor in there to read to make sure that the oxygen levels and there's no CO2 and decomposing plant matter and stuff like that. And then once we check out it's okay, then we actually had to set up like a rescue arm, like what you'd almost see somebody to pull a motor out of a car. We had to set that up over the hole and then hook a pulley to it. And then, so if the guy went down and he had problems, we could crank him back up and swing him to the side. And we really hadn't had to do that in the past, but with the training we've been getting, they're starting to identify the right ways to do things. That once we get trained, we start to look at the spaces different. And then we know what we're supposed to do, and it's up to us to do it. So.
You have a strong appreciation for, you know, the processes in terms of safety. I had a grandfather who was a coal miner, and they relied on a canary. Mm-hmm. You know, we've come a long way.
Yeah. No, we just have a little
bit. Got to share that Josh and I chatted a little bit beforehand, and we've got something in common. He said he always figures that if he doesn't hear from anybody and he's doing his job well, and so it goes unnoticed. And I said, well, that's how I try to feel as a commissioner. If nobody notices us, we're doing well. But so we have something in common there. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Any other thoughts or comments?
And everything's working well and doing what it's supposed to do?
Yeah, it seems to be.
Good.
I haven't heard anything.
Oh. That's
and that's always good news.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Yeah, great. Good job.
We
thanks,
not
guys.
We appreciate your work. We appreciate you and your attitudes about it. Yeah. Thank you. Quarterly Energy Resource.
Yep. Want to invite our energy resource team to come on up. Greg, Janet, Andrew. Presenting on the quarterly energy resources update. This is for the second quarter.
Will there be a peek in the bag? Or?
There will not.
There will not. All right.
Commissioners, Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources.
Janet Jaspers, Energy Planning and Trading Manager.
And Andrew Grissell, and as you'll hear a little bit later, we're transitioning a little bit to from energy efficiency only into something we're calling customer energy solutions. So
our agenda for today is similar to what we have done in the past, a portfolio overview, a review of operations, a market update, and energy efficiency update. We have added a new slide to this presentation, and I'll highlight to you some of the differences that we're going to be talking about. Key message points for this presentation is that overall our wholesale revenues are off by about $0.3 million, and that'll change by the end of the year, so it'll expected to go up over time. Specified source energy sales, if you remember, are the environmental attributes that we sell primarily to California. Those are up by $1.2 million. We're working towards meeting our goals. We're halfway through the year, so Andrew will provide you an update on that. And Andrew will talk a little bit about some of the other things that we're doing for customers as well, because his group has been involved, as you know, developing the charging for electric vehicles, meeting with customers. They have questions about setting up chargers and things of that nature. So here's the new slide that Steve asked us to provide, and I thought it was a really good idea because the things in the energy market are changing rapidly over the next several years. The first one has to do with reliability coordination services. I think Steve, during one of his manager's updates, had provided you with an overview of what's happening on the reliability coordinator. Peak RC, who has been doing those services, is basically giving us notice that they're going to stop providing reliability coordinating operations by the end of 2019. Cal ISO has agreed to provide services. So one thing I did want to provide with you all is a copy of a letter that we received on Friday from the Bonneville Power Administration, basically saying that they have selected Cal ISO as their RC in the future. There were several options that were available. So this is the first step in people moving into Cal ISO for providing reliability coordination services. In their letter, they do reference that they are doing this because they see Cal ISO as providing significant reliability experience. But the only thing you should know is that Cal ISO has never been a reliability coordinator. They have provided transmission service provider in the past, so this is going to be new to Cal ISO. So they don't really have a lot of experience, as is highlighted in this memo. And then the other thing that they say, they felt comfortable moving forward with this because of the governance associated with the Cal ISO. We think there could be some improvements on governance. And then finally, they say that this decision is not tied to Bonneville's desire to move into Cal ISO EIM. However, they have pulled together a new team that they're calling Grid Modernization, and that team is currently working on EIM implementation measures. So everybody in the region understands that it's likely that Bonneville will be joining Cal ISO EIM at some point in the near future. Now, the reason I care about that is because the EIM, the with-hour trading that occurs right now, and I have it on the second bullet, leads into real-time operations, which leads into day-ahead trading. One of the things that are currently being discussed in Cal ISO right now is what's called EDAM, which is Extended Day Ahead Market, which is all of the trading that occurs from the day ahead all the way through inter-hour trading that occurs. So in the past, we have evaluated whether or not we should participate in the energy imbalance market. Just so you know, the inter-hour stuff represents 4% of the trades that occur in this region. But now that it's moving into the day-ahead market, day-ahead markets represent 40% of all the trades that occur within the western region. So the transition and the possibility of this within-hour trading moving into the day-ahead is a fairly significant event that is occurring. And whether or not that happens, it is yet to be seen. But all indications are that's what they're aiming for in the future as well.
Greg, that was 4% and 40%.
Four to 40%. Okay. That's correct.
So, Greg, is there any sense that California is, I guess I would use the word, actively considering changes in their governance model that would be more inclusive of the broader region?
There is a bill, AB 813, that's currently before their houses, in both houses within California, and that proposes some governance changes and allowing them to participate in a regional governance model. Whether or not that happens, I understand that the chances of that bill passing are 50-50. If it doesn't pass, then I think we would have to rely on the stakeholder input processes that CAISO has. They have set up some independent boards for EIM, as an example. We're unsure right now whether that governance board for EIM is going to be set up for the EDAM, for what, the extended day ahead market, or not. It's not clear at this particular moment. So far, that independent board, which consists of regional people that have been appointed to it, has not been overridden by any of the California ruled, you know, everything goes through the governor's office in the end. And so even though it's kind of labeled as an independent board, it still has to go through the governance structure of the state of California. So it's not a perfect setup currently, but it hasn't, you know, the decisions that have been made in that board have not been overruled. And Steve, is there anything you want to add to that?
That was a really good description.
Okay. So we're working on it. We're not a member of CAISO, so the only way that we can participate is by going to stakeholder meetings. Their stakeholder meetings are the type of things where you show up in the room and they have a microphone at the front and you can wait in line to participate. Yeah, you know, by going up to the microphone, but it's not what I would consider to be a very dynamic conversation or a two-way conversation with CAISO because we're not members of the EIM. Okay. Yeah.
Greg, do you see the relationship changing with the CAISO and maybe being removed from control of the governor's office from California?
Well, that's the proposal within the AB 813. And I think the region as a whole would like to see that happen because it's all, people get along when things are normal, but when there's ever a problem within the system, then what you have the tendency to do is go back to your roots and protect yourself first. And what we're afraid of is that if the governance structure isn't designed in such a way that it looks at the reliability of the entire system in a very objective way, then we could have a problem in the future. That makes sense?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. You know, a lot of this is governed by a lot of the state carbon policies that are currently out there. And in the future, when I come back here, to the extent that there is any legislation that's being proposed or passed or regulatory aspects, I think it's going to be important for me to convey to you that if this bill passed, here's what I see as the impact on the market as a whole. So I plan on coming back, and because this is governing the number of renewables that are in the system and what's being done in order to effectuate change regarding the decarbonization of the grid. And it's going to be very important that I come back to you in the future and talk to you about that. And then it affects the last bullet on here is we have hydropower, which I consider to be a great asset. We have the ability to make changes in our operations every 4 seconds. So to the extent that it's carbon-free, to the extent that it's renewable, to the extent that we can include incremental hydro either in Washington or Oregon, and to the extent that those things change in the future, I will provide you an update on quarterly updates from now on as to what I'm seeing happen and what changes are occurring. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
So this is just going to be a little bit different dynamic that we'll be able to provide you an update on.
And timely.
And yeah, and there's so much happening in the next 2 years. It's going to be a whirlwind, and it's going to be important that we stay on top of it. Okay? So sorry to be so long-winded on that first slide, but it's, it'll be, I think it'll be important in the future. District load resource balance, the one thing you should know is that we have not implemented a slice in 2018 yet. We normally do that by Q1. We pushed that to Q4. The reason we did it is because, as you all know, we're working on large loads in our system, and we're not sure how new large loads, how many people are going to be applying for the new rate that is eventually established. We don't know how it affects our overall load resource balance. And so rather than going out there and sell something in advance, you know, we are hedged up tight for the next 3 to 4 years, which we've been communicating to anybody who is wanting to get service from us. We decided to wait a little bit and observe what would happen. And when new rates are published and we can see how many people actually apply, then we'll revisit that and we may go in there. Now, on the next page, you can see that we had already implemented some slice sales to Avista. So we're not in a bad position as it stands right now, because normally 1 year out we have 250 megawatts sold, and it goes to 200, 150, all the way down to 50. But you can see in 2021 and 2022, we do already have a lot hedged up because of the long-term sale that we did for Avista. So we're not, even if we decided not to do a slice this year because of uncertainty and load resource balance, we're not going to be far off because of the fact that we did do that long-term sale with Avista. Okay? With that, I'm going to turn it over to Janet, and she's going to provide you an overview of Streamflow and then get into kind of the market aspects of it as well.
Good morning. Thanks, Greg. So looking at the Columbia River flow so far this year, you can see we had very high flows, and May was kind of record flows at 187% of normal. And just because we had those record flows in May, it took some of our water supply out of the fall. And so, as you can see, July is below normal. We're expecting August and September to also be below normal. This chart is just showing the water supply forecast at Grand Coulee for the January through July time period. And the green line is average, so kind of in the fall, pretty much average. Then it started increasing at one point, kind of in the May time period, April May time period. I think we were close to 130% of average. After that, it came down and we ended up at 119% of average. Then, kind of looking at seasonal outlooks for August, September, and October. On the left is precip. We're looking kind of below precip or equal chances at above or below precip, excuse me. On the right-hand side, we have temperatures. And you can see that we're forecast to have above normal temperatures for the next 3 months.
You also can see that as a fire map as well. I mean, except for on the East Coast. It should be blue over on the East Coast.
Or it could be the smoking X. Kind of red over one at you today. The Canadian forecasters for that same time period, August, September, and October. On the left, we have precip. So kind of normal precip forecasted. On the right, we have temperature. In red is warmer than normal forecast. Switching over to natural gas prices. Last time we were here with the Q1 update, natural gas was $2.92. And on August 8th, it was $2.89. So not, but it kind of went down and came back up. But overall, not that much movement. Kind of looks pretty volatile.
Unless you're some of the gas markets in California. Those are pretty interesting.
Yeah, there's some localized congestion in those storage.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we saw probably $14 gas for a couple of days.
Well, one page next.
Yeah, and then just kind of showing the last slide, which is just the portion of the graph inside the yellow box. And so, you know, in the past, we're up $13, $14. For this same September 2018 Henry Hub contract. And so we're just kind of some small noise as compared to some of the historical movements. Switching over to wholesale electricity prices. This is in Columbia flat annual prices, and this is in dollars per megawatt hour. So 2018, at budget time, we're just over, we're forecasting $22.76. And currently, just because we've had some real high prices in July and early August, we're right around 29.14. Then looking at the forward price curve, so this is for the I-Stay Ahead indices for previous months. So for the first 6 months, and then the forward forecast for the rest. You can see that Q3 prices really spiked up in July and August. Q2 prices were actually below, so it might even out.
One thing you should be aware of, in July, we did see some huge volatility in power prices. Mid-C was trading 300s, and California was trading in the $900 range. So just very short peaks, but it was pretty significant during those time periods as well. We do pay attention to what pricing is in the region and see if there's patterns that are forming, you know, because of, you know, the famous duck belly curve. That you all are familiar with. We were expecting that you would start to see some heavy pricing in the evening hours when you have that up ramp occurring. We're starting to see some patterns forming regarding that. You know, up until now, we haven't, but certainly during those few days, there was a huge uptick during the hours and the evening hours as well. So when I come back and talk to you about that one slide at the very beginning, I'll let you know, kind of what our observations are. And this is where the, you know, our hydropower and our flexibility is going to be very important, because we do have the ability to instantaneously up ramp if we want to do that. And so we'll keep you updated as far as what we're seeing in the market as well.
And here's our Q2 forecast for the 2018 net wholesale revenue. And so at budget time, we were forecasting $116.3 million. Our current forecast is we're right at $116 million, so down about $300,000. As part of that, our specified source forecast is quite a bit above our budget. It's close to $5 million. Our budget was 3.7, so 1.2 above budget. That's probably the most significant thing.
Yeah.
And these were at a snapshot in time. And so this forecast is as of July 6th.
One of the things you'll see in the future is that we'll always, we have a forecast in there, but the Alcoa, we're going to, in the future, just put in there what the actuals were, because we can't forecast, you know, what we're going to get from Alcoa, because everything goes into the daily market. And then the other thing is on the real-time revenue. In July, I talked about that volatility. Part of that contract, if there's huge variability associated with that, our amount that we would get paid would go up. So you would, next time we come in, you'll see the real-time revenue probably go up as well.
And so, looking out forward until 2027, here's our net wholesale revenue forecast. And so the black line is our current, and it is just slightly above last quarter's update, just because of a small increase in the forward price curve. Switching to Lakeland Lake Level webpage, we're currently just above 1099 feet, and just kind of at the bottom of the blue normal operating zone. We have had just a slight draft recently for for some fisheries studies.
We're basically digging a hole in Lake Chelan because we only have the ability to release through spillage right now. So in order to maintain constant flows of 85 CFS in the bypass reach, we had to lower the reservoir because the inflow is greater than 85 CFS. And we then, while we're releasing the 85 CFS for the fish studies, the lake will come back up. So we had to, like, give ourselves a little bit of a buffer. That's the reasons why we had to. So if anybody asks you questions about why the lake is a little bit, you know, 0.3 foot, 4 inches lower than normal, that's the reason we're doing that.
And then just to touch on the info slide, so our community choice aggregators are expanding in California, mainly in Southern California. And so there's going to be 4 new CCAs for a total of 13. So 6 are expected to begin in September. Pacific, Gas and Electric, I can always say PG&E. Sees the company losing as much as 50% of their retail customers by 2020.
It's big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the California PUC warned that as much as 80% of the IOU retail customers could shift to the CCAs. Direct access providers and rooftop solar between 2020 and 2024.
So the one thing to balance.
Yeah, the one thing that's surprising to me is when they did a cost comparison, because between IOUs and the CCAs, so if you go in there, they did a study that I don't remember who did, but they're showing that the CCAs were able to lower the price by only 3%, which to me isn't a very significant. And then just recently, CCAs have been required to provide resource adequacy and reliability services as well. So I would expect that any decrease in pricing that occurred because they were able to provide services without providing all of the reliability services, I would expect that that margin would be probably consumed by increased responsibilities of the CCAs in the future. So net-net, I think you're going to see that the CCAs are going to be providing pricing that's very similar to what PG&E, because of the regulatory regime in California, makes things extremely expensive, and going in there, you know, like the renewable portfolio standards and taxes and things like that in California. So this loss of load and loss of customers is the number one issue associated with IOUs. They're very, very concerned about it, and we're concerned about it from a reliability perspective as well, because we're all one grid, and if there's reliability issues in the future and you have stranded assets, then you could end up with reliability issues in the future.
At some moment in the future, not today, it would be an interesting tutorial to understand how going up through a city block, one customer can have one provider and one customer another, all on the same set of wires.
Yeah, so far the CCAs have formed consolidated groups, so it's not every other customer in this region. I think in other regions they do provide that sort of service. In California, it's been like groups, like entire cities that have joined the CCAs, mm-hmm. and it's not been customer by customer. Do you have any other clarification on that?
So a CCA only provides the generating resource, provides the energy. The distribution provider stays the same. So if in Marin County, Pacific Gas and Electric still provides transmission and distribution services, the CCA just provides the power, basically. And so it doesn't change in terms of if you're neighbors, you're served the same in the past, and that PG&E is providing that distribution service. The only difference is where your power is coming from. And that is the same for everybody on the block. So Marin County, everybody in Marin County is getting power from the Marin County CCA.
Yeah. Under the CCA, but I know in La Quinta, which is where Imperial Valley Irrigation District is, and the other part is served by Southern California Edison. The realtors literally carry maps because this side of the street is Imperial.
Yeah, there's going to be
this side.
Yeah.
So those things occur, and I don't know if that's what you were driving at, but the differential is $300. Air conditioning bills versus 6 to 9. Mm-hmm. And they live on one side of the street and one lives on the other.
Oh. You can have that in Washington State too.
Yes,
where you have,
yes, we can.
Letting service territories.
Right. Yeah. So it's more of a service territory issue,
right?
it's an interesting one to look at that fortunately we don't have to deal with.
Yeah, there's not a lot of people that want to jump off of our power rates.
No.
Okay, thanks. And so over on the right-hand side, a new integrated resource plan process puts emissions reductions at the center of planning for power providers. And so Southern Cal Ed calls for about 4,200 megawatts of renewables and 1,600 of new energy storage. Pacific Gas and Electric really didn't see a new need for renewables. And here it says the utility expects 42% of its demand to migrate to CCAs by the end of 2019. And over here we saw 50% by 2020, so another 8% in 2020. And then San Diego Gas and Electric identified a need for only approximately 700 gigawatts of incremental renewable power in the outer years of the planning period.
Okay. I just want to add that while the IOUs are reducing their proposed purchases, the CCAs are increasing theirs. So we still are seeing a pretty significant build set of issues associated with California as this transition is occurring.
And I'm going to hand it off to you.
So one thing to keep in mind, though, is from a selling to California perspective, when you get a whole bunch of smaller CCAs that don't have a credit history, the selling characteristics going into California, the dynamic's a little bit different because you have a whole bunch of people who have no credit history. And so the credit aspect of all of this, and you're talking about huge amounts of money, associated with the energy supply into California, it's a little bit different world that we're working on. And of course, we don't sell directly to California. Our power purchasers deal with them mostly, but you can see where that would affect their ability to sell into California as well. Okay, sorry about that.
Shifting gears just a little bit. Following is the Q2 energy efficiency update. And just as a reminder, our two-year compliance target is 2.42 average megawatts. We have an annual 2018 stretch goal of 1.7 average megawatts. So we're on track at this point in time. We're just short of about one average megawatt for the year so far in our savings. And we're doing so cost-effectively when you look at what our value is over the life versus what we're spending. So we're on track on all of those. And then this is interesting information that the Washington Department of Commerce sent to us. And what we have is we have all of the I-937 utilities on the side. We have what their 2016-17 targets were, and then per year what their how much they acquired. And so, for example, here we are in the yellow. Our target was about 15,500 megawatt hours. And you can see that for each of the years we were over 18,000 megawatt hours. And so, also, we were in about third place. We were within the top three as far as the percentage over the target, and we did this all cost effectively. We did this, which is a real testament to our team, as low as our rates are, that they're able to still develop and come up with programs where we can move the needle on energy efficiency as well as doing it in a cost-effective manner, providing both the customer and the utility value. So I wanted to share that with the group and thought it was an important note.
So I looked at this early and I saw the number from Cowlitz, and I just wondered if they had started with what I would call a lot more low-hanging fruit.
Comes primarily from one really large industrial customer that they had. It was in the multiple megawatts of savings.
Wow.
And so so that's where that one. There was actually, I don't remember the exact part of the law, but there was some legislation that they went and changed so that they could keep counting those savings over time. That if you went in and did a really big project, you would be able to keep doing that over time. And so, so that was that one little bit of an outlier.
So, and even though these numbers seem relatively small when you look at how much energy we generate, the one thing I remind you of is that it's accumulative from year to year. So Andrew's team up until this point is, I think we're in the 20 megawatt range, you know, so when we trade energy, selling blocks of energy in the 25 megawatt range is considered to be significant. So all of this stuff adding up over time and getting into the 20 average megawatts is fairly significant from a savings perspective on Chelan for our ability to market that energy in the market as well. Okay.
And the customers love it.
And the customers yes. love it. Yeah, everybody likes my parents are an example of that. Yeah.
And on this slide, I wanted to just show a few things of interest that the team has been doing besides just the energy efficiency acquisition. First one, we're transitioning from an energy efficiency only group to something called Customer Energy Solutions. And our goal there is to be seen as a trusted energy advisor for our customers, providing customers and Chelan PUD with greater value. And so as the district, as well as just society in general, brings on new technologies and softwares, we want to be prepared to take advantage of those opportunities as they arise and be able to, you know, find additional ways of value. So some examples of those are areas to include, we'll have continued excellence in our energy efficiency programs. That's still right up in front for us. That's our number one priority. But we also want to help customers with things like strategic energy management, which that focuses more on the operations, not just, you know, incentivizing the widget to put in, but going in and helping them, how can you operate your facility better, more efficiently, more valuable. Of course, electric vehicle support, we've been taking on that role, and we continue to do so, working with other utilities in the region. Demand response, we've got a couple pilots on that that we think we might be getting going. So some interesting work there, and we'll report as that comes on. And then also some beneficial uses of batteries, and I've got an example proposal we developed with a couple of our other entities down a little bit lower, and where those might be able to help out in some areas. And then just a note, we're still in the very early stages of this transition, but are excited at the potential opportunities that lie ahead as we start looking at how can we provide even more value to our customers. The next update, LED streetlight project. We're bringing this one up for an update now because we have awarded the bid to a contractor. The bid came in significantly under what our estimates were, so that was great. And we've combed through it, and it meets everything that we needed to do. So that was fantastic for both our city, county partners, as well as ourselves. And then the work is going to begin in September and should be completed by the end of the year. Once they get moving, they can move fairly quickly. We're working on something we want you to know. We're working on communications with the cities and the county, how to communicate with their constituents. They are responsible for fielding the questions. We had this early on that this is one of the conditions of us helping to facilitate the transition to LED streetlights, and so they're responsible for fielding their questions, and as it's their lights. Though in almost all conditions, it's their lights on their poles, or they've asked us to do that. And so we are working with them on communications tools and tech packages. But then we're going to, when people call, they need to speak with them. We're acting as the facilitator to help get the dollars, to help get the project done, and we've been able to do it much more cost-effectively and reasonably than if they had done it through some other mechanism. And so
if you get any phone calls about the LED lights and the, you know, the light characteristics change, Andrew has a contact at the cities that are because they choose kind of like the amount that light characteristics of the particular light, and there's also things that they can do like diffusers and stuff like that. But we're not the ones doing it. It would be the city that would be doing it.
Right.
And so they help develop our standards.
And we've had some recent experience with a customer, and I will say to the credit of our employees, John Stoll and group, have handled that extremely well. And I'm much appreciative of that as the person that got the contact, and to be able to say to our staff, here's an issue, off of that, and good work with it.
We
lost it. No, I actually thought we were just going to try and do this in between, lunch, but I think she wanted to hear.
Okay.
Welcome back, Ann.
Thank you.
And so, but it's been a good project to work with. We've worked really closely with all the cities we've worked with. They've helped develop their standards, and it's going to be a good project when it's done.
And it was a city light.
Yes. Yep. So. And then also just some news on Cashmere School. through our local government program that we have, we're working with Cashmere School to upgrade some of their schools. So we're looking at almost between 750,000 to 1 million kilowatt hours in savings, and up to $300,000 in incentives that we'll be able to provide the school and help them fund energy efficiency upgrades at the facilities. And then, of course, those numbers are all depend on final savings numbers, but in general, so it's a great program that we've put together. We're also working with a couple of the other schools to continue some of their efforts. We've had really good, I would say, partnerships with the schools, and we continue to work on that even more so. And then getting back to strategic energy management, and just quickly, in case you hear of some things, we're working with Town Toyota Center. And what we're really doing is we're going out there and looking at their facilities, looking how they operate, and then seeing if there's low-cost, no-cost changes. And what we found, even with the Town Toyota Center, is that there's probably up to 1.3 million kilowatt hours of savings that's available just through changing some of the ways they operate. Now, there's also some low-cost capital improvements, but they're low-cost. They're not super expensive, and our incentives can help pay for those as well. And so we're really out there working with them, helping them do that. We've also been working with Confluence Health to acquire another 750,000 kilowatt hours through managing their systems differently. They did it a little bit differently, as they had a couple campuses that had a competition going in between who can go out and find things, you know, throughout. And it's been really successful, and they've been very happy with what they've been learning and how we've been working with them. And so those are just a couple more examples of us, you know, providing additional services to our customers for value. And then finally, we've teamed up with Link and Pacific Northwest National Labs to develop and submit a proposal to identify ways to reduce the demand of high-speed charging on the on our system. So as the buses pull in, they use a lot of energy quickly. So options do include battery technology. Is there a way to have a battery there that, you know, kind of trickle charges all day long? Bus comes in, depletes it. Lower impacts on the system. We haven't heard anything back. It's a Department of Energy grant process, and we haven't heard anything back on that. But that's some of the other things we're looking at doing. So,
before you go to your summary, just an aside, but in your arena, and you're probably aware of it, Tesla entered into a long-term contract with Dan's Food Mart up in Leavenworth,
right.
And they put in a 10-car charging station. The aside is I was coming through Leavenworth two Sundays ago, and this just opened. And there were six cars parked in that. I
drove by, and all of them were full, and I almost drove off the road. Seriously. Because I was driving the opposite direction. Yeah. They have the fence there, so I had to do one of these, and then I was like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm impressed with them. You know, build it, and they will come.
Yeah, well, the one thing to keep in mind, though, that is a 0.75 megawatt load. So when you have all of the charging stations up and running, is a fairly significant load on our system that we need to take a look at.
There's a rates issue there that we're already working on.
We'll
be bringing to the board.
Ah.
Yeah, and by the way, that is the largest charging station, I guess, on the West Coast.
For Tesla?
For Tesla, for superchargers, just really? So you know. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Guess who drives to Leavenworth?
Yes. Okay, this is just a summary of the things that we already talked about. We're, you know, doing a good job staying on target with our forecasted. We're doing a really good job on specified source energy as it flows into California. And Andrew just gave you an overview on energy efficiency and now all of the other things. It should be energy efficiency plus because there's so many other things that we do now. So with that, find out if you have any other questions.
And if not, I'm going to keep us moving because we're slipping behind.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
So next up, I want to invite Lorna Klimansky to talk about HR and safety legislative update.
Good morning. As Steve mentioned, I'm Lorna Klimansky, Managing Director of Human Resources and Safety. It was a busy year this year with Democrats in control of both houses for the first time since 2012 and a Democrat in the governor's office. Pro-labor groups proposed a lot of employment-related bills, and they saw a lot of success this session. We analyzed more than three dozen bills and provided public comment on many of them. In some cases, we collaborated with WAPUTA, the Association of Washington Cities, and or the Washington State Association of Counties to increase our impact and to keep a lower profile. So more than a dozen employment bills were enacted in the recent session, most with an effective date of June 7th, which didn't really allow a lot of time to understand the bills and to determine what actions were needed from us to comply. In some cases, our practices were already in compliance with the new law, or it was not applicable to us, or the law will only have to be addressed in specific circumstances. So bills listed in red are ones that required action from us and that we're still working on. Blue font indicates it's complete or substantially complete. And I'm going to move through these very quickly because we are running behind. So in anticipation of potential rollbacks to the Affordable Care Act at the federal level, the bills relating to health plan benefits secured certain benefits for people in Washington that are covered by fully insured plans who are self-insured employers, so neither of those bills applied to us. The Equal Pay Opportunity Act is the bill requiring the most significant changes to how we do business, and along with a lot of uncertainty. It's aimed at addressing workplace practices in order to achieve gender pay equity and to level the playing field for job and promotional opportunities, which, of course, we support. And we responded by immediately ceasing to ask job candidates for their pay histories. And we've undertaken a risk-based view of other policies, procedures, and practices to identify and prioritize efforts to eliminate or significantly reduce our risk of being found to have practices resulting in gender pay discrimination. The Act requires equal pay for similarly employed workers, and 100% of any difference must be explained by five specific factors. The difficulty is knowing what similarly employed means, and that'll likely be clarified by future litigation. So stay tuned on that. For discrimination, the two bills listed there will have little or no impact on us. The first is related to employment contracts, which for the most part does not apply to us. And the second item would only apply if we were to enter into an agreement with a non-disclosure clause, so it does not require immediate change to current practices. Under labor relations, we were already collecting dues from union members and remitting them to the union, so we were already in compliance on that requirement. And the second item requires us to provide bargaining unit representatives 30 minutes of access during the first 90 days. We have a collaborative relationship and have offered to work with the IBEW on how to implement this requirement. Although IBEW has not yet responded at this time, we expect they will want to take advantage of this provision, especially following the Supreme Court's decision in the Janus v. AFSCME case, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Payroll had a few items to respond to as well. Implementing the Student Opportunity Assistance and Relief Act required us to amend the amount of private student loans exempt from garnishments and make a change to our procedures for garnishments. That's done, and just one employee was affected. Our procedures for paying wages and benefits on the death of an employee were also generally in compliance with requirements of that new law about how and when to pay what is owed when an employee passes away in service. We had to make changes to some of our forms and affidavits. Regarding making child support payments by electronic funds transfer, we've been making child support payments online for some time, and therefore we're already in compliance with that requirement. On the PERS rate change, it becomes effective in September, and payroll has prepared to implement that rate change. The increase is 0.13% and will cost the district approximately an additional $95,000 annually. In recruiting, the Fair Chance Act prohibits employers from asking about arrests or convictions before an applicant is otherwise determined to be qualified for a position, and that caused us to change some of our selection procedures and our job announcements. We also changed our process for getting driving records and how we evaluate the points on driving records to determine whether applicants are eligible to advance in our selection processes or not.
Lorna, a question on the recruiting. Mm-hmm. Does that also include predatory?
Well, we can't ask about convictions at all. Okay. At the front end before we decide whether or not someone's eligible. Once we've decided they're eligible, then we get to ask stuff.
Thank you.
Yep. On safety, we were happy about the bill providing utility workers with the same work zone safety protections as road construction workers. To receive the protections, we must meet certain requirements about warning lights and placement of cones, and we've already been complying with those requirements, so this bill is all benefit to us and to our workers. The domestic violence leave law protects employees and job seekers who have been victims of domestic assault from employment discrimination. In the past, we have typically handled these on a case-by-case basis because each situation is pretty specific to the individual circumstances. So I'll continue to work with security and our recruiting team to ensure we are taking appropriate measures to protect and maintain the confidentiality of employees or job seekers who have been subjected to domestic violence and to allow time off for protected activities. But wait, there's more. In addition to the 2018 legislative session, we've been responding to other employment and safety-related issues. On confined space, you just heard from the Tech Shop CPO winners that we are currently training our affected employees and updating our procedures to comply with changes to the state's confined space regulations. The new procedures will be implemented when all affected employees have been trained, which we expect to be complete before the end of the year. And we're still sorting through what the Supreme Court decision in the Janus case means for us. The decision made it illegal to require non-union members to pay what are called agency fees to unions for services provided in terms of bargaining wages and benefits and administering the grievance process. In addition, it seems the decision may mean employees cannot be compelled to be union members. Therefore, we'll need to amend our union security clause, change some of our forms, and notify current employees regarding what the decision in Janus v. AFSCME means to them regarding their union membership. We have already suspended withholding membership fees for some employees and are attempting to reconcile our records with the unions regarding signed membership cards. And we've also notified the union of our desire to negotiate a change to the union security clause in the collective bargaining agreement. And then you may not be aware, we have employees working in Montana, Oregon, and occasionally Colorado. So we have to comply with employment laws and remit taxes for those states. This year, implementation of a new tax in Oregon required a significant effort to program changes to our payroll system, tax tables, and pay statements so we could collect and remit the tax and comply with requirements for providing information to those employees. And providing input in rulemaking processes is an effort we prioritize. And we commented on the draft Department of Safety and Health lead rule at a hearing on July 27th. L&I staff are currently working toward a third draft to be released to the public in advance of the rule proposal filing. L&I has not provided a timeline for the remainder of that rulemaking process, so we're not sure what to do, but our work is complete for now on this item until we know more about the next steps in the rulemaking process. And an item which might have either a very significant impact or might have very little effect on us is L&I's pre-proposal submitted in March to begin a review and potential rulemaking on exemptions from the Minimum Wage Act. We're monitoring action on this and plan to carefully review and provide input regarding any proposed rule changes, rules for the administrative, executive, professional, computer, highly paid executive, and outside salesperson exemptions determine which positions are exempt from the requirement to pay overtime for hours actually worked beyond 40 in a standard work week. The state's Minimum Wage Act and the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act both address these exemptions and both apply both a salary test and a duties set of duties tests to those exemptions. So differences between the laws are currently relatively minimal. Among rule changes being considered are possible changes to the salary level test. Some of the examples would more than double or even triple the federal salary level test. That would make more positions subject to the requirement to pay overtime. On the duties tests, one of the pre-proposals is actually to align the state duties tests more closely with the federal duties tests. That'd be great. But, of course, other proposals might have the state duties test drifting even further from the federal standard, and that would be more difficult to both administer and to educate managers about. I'll bash on if there are no questions. And then, you know, we already have a myriad of paid leave regulations in addition to what we were already dealing with in a belt and suspenders approach to the legislature last year enacted paid family and medical leave insurance, hot on the heels of the voter-approved initiative on paid sick leave. So the Department of Labor and Industry finalized rules for paid sick leave on October 19th of last year, and they became effective on January 1st of this year, which allowed little time to bargain new contract language and make policy changes before the January implementation. And we've done both of those and continue to monitor any implementation issues. Modifications made to our PL policy and collective bargaining agreement language so that our PL would meet the paid sick leave law requirements included employee notification signature requirements for cashing leave out at separation were put into place. Non-bargaining unit non-exempts must sign at termination to receive that PL cash out. We eliminated emergency PL cash outs and mid-year PL cash outs because those are not allowed under the paid sick leave law. Reduce the ability to deny any PL requests unless we establish that the PL request is not for an authorized paid sick leave reason. And we also cannot require advance notice for PL requests as we did in the past. We cannot take discipline for excessive use any longer, and we can no longer require use of PL for time off. What will be more difficult even than that is harmonizing our short-term disability benefit plan with the state's family medical leave insurance, which is going into effect beginning in 2019 and 2020. The state is still in rulemaking phases on paid family medical leave insurance. The rules are expected to be finalized in March of 2019 and to go into effect in April. We'll already be responsible for collecting and remitting the premiums as well as making quarterly reports beginning in January of 2019, though. Meanwhile, we'll be challenged with administering family and medical leave insurance with recent paid sick leave law, our short-term disability benefits, but also our paid leave policy, federal laws, contract, etc. So if you want to know more about this, complexities of this, the next slide contains a high-level summary, which I promise I won't cover, but I'll be happy to answer any questions either now or later.
Questions, comments, commissioners?
Been a busy year.
It was a busy year.
Thank you.
Lorna, how do small companies keep up with this? This is amazing.
I have no idea, especially when I think about some of the utilities in Waputa that are quite small.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. It is daunting. I have some experts that can help me with some of this, but it is crazy town.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you.
You can see why we've encouraged WAPU to engage more on some of these issues.
Yes.
Expressive view as to the magnitude of things that are coming at us. And thank you, Lorna. Move now to a discussion of fire hardening protection for our transmission system. So Chad Bowman and Steve Wickle will be presenting. To be clear, this is one where we're going to be asking the board at the end. We have a proposal for how we think we might proceed with this, but we're really looking for not a vote, but a head nod as to is this a reasonable way to proceed to the next step here.
Good morning. I'm Chad Bowman, Director of Transmission Compliance. Steve is really, and Jim back in the audience there, really the ones that have done a lot of work on this, and interested in your feedback on how we might move this forward.
Good morning. Again, I'm Steve Wickle, Transmission Engineering Manager. Objective of this presentation, first and foremost, we aren't looking for a board decision today. This is really just a discussion of potential mitigation approaches to fire hardening the Chelan service area. And it does align with our district strategic plan, any of the proposals or approaches that we have in here. So why are we here? As I just said, the district strategic plan in green there says our customer owners were most interested in replacing or rerouting some electric lines to protect against fire and weather risks. And in the lower left-hand corner, the 2018 to 2022 district-wide business plan, there is a line item in there for hardening transmission systems to protect against fire and weather. These are just some interesting pictures from the 2015 Chelan fire. This two transmission lines there were affected. I'll discuss that, I believe, right here. So We do have some pretty good operational experience here at Chelan PUD with fire and fire response over the recent years. The fire caused outage of 4 of 5 substations in the Chelan area in 2015. There were 12 transmission structures on 2 different transmission lines. Significant customer impacts, of course, water and gasoline, internet, cell service, all of that. But something I think John Stoll mentioned last time as we were talking about this was just the ability to even process a credit card. There was nothing that could go on in that city during the time that they were in a blackout. And it took about 30 hours to repair the first transmission line. So they were in the dark for 30-plus hours, and then 13 days to repair the second. Luckily, after 30 hours, they were able to get the power restored to substations. So following that, we did a fire risk assessment in 2017. We hired a consultant, HDR, who's done an awful lot of transmission line work for us over the years. This really validated our actual experience from the 2015 fire. There was extensive damage in Area 2. So this Area 2 to the right, where the orange and red and yellow are, is where the damage actually occurred. And this is where the fire risk assessment showed there was risk. Of course, there's Area 1. So Area 1 is about 18 miles of essentially a big loop, 210 structures or so, that goes to clear out to Manson and the Wapato substations. There's kind of a, we call it geographic diversity. So obviously there's a lot of yellow and orange there as well. However, they're separated by, you know, a couple of miles apart. Plus there's configurability to that. There's a lot of line switches on there. We can take big sections of transmission line out to replace structures or whatever and still maintain power to the customers. So Area 2, however, is really 3.5 miles long from Chelan Falls, which is the hydro project down in the lower right. There's 3.5 miles of 2 parallel lines, and both lines burned at the same time in that 2015 fire. So our projects that we're going to propose in here or approaches really are on Area 2. So moving to benefits of steel transmission lines. So in 2014, the South Malaga fire, some of you may remember, there were 7 wood lines from us, BPA, and Douglas that all burned, and there was 1 steel line from our Wenatchee substation or switchyard to Malaga or down to McKinsey, and that was the only reason we were able to restore power to Alcoa, and it still took hours that night just in the chaos of everything that burned down there. In 2018, just at the start of summer, that fire near Rocky Reach burned right through our Rocky Reach to Andrew York 230 kV line, and we didn't even take it out of service. Fire burned right through it, but it's steel construction, and it remained in service. So what if one of the Chelan transmission lines, one of those 2, had been done in steel? It's very likely that power would not have even been removed from service. Really, the only time we do take those lines out of service when fires roll through is at the request of the incident commander of the fire teams, just in case they think there's a safety problem. So real quick word on steel pole construction and aesthetics. The proposed projects that we have are really just to replace wood poles with steel. It's not a reroute. We're not going to a new alignment. It's just the same alignment replacing with steel poles. The picture on the left is a steel structure in the front that's being replaced. This is on that Wenatchee-McKinsey line that actually saved Alcoa in the fire in 2014. And then on the right, same transmission line, but the middle structure there is steel. The 2 on the right are wood. So it really aesthetically isn't much of a difference. Real quick word on the Chelan loads. This is that loop in just more of a pictograph style. There's 4 substations, the Chelan, Union Valley, Manson, and Wapato. They're in white, over 8,500 customers there. The North Shore is in yellow. That's the new proposed substation that's going in up in North Shore. And it does show the Greater Wenatchee Irrigation District off to the kind of the right there is also directly fed from our 115 transmission system up there. So approach 1, finally getting to the meat of this. In red, one approach we could take is to rebuild in steel entirely from Chelan Falls Switchyard to Union Valley. Again, it's about approximately 4 miles, 35 structures, and there's direct benefit to both Union Valley and Chelan substations, so that's over 3,500 customers. And then because even if a fire were to go through there, and even if we had to de-energize the line, as soon as everything's safe, it's essentially a light switch. You turn it back on, and so then that geographic diversity, the Manson and Wapato that are further out there, they would benefit greatly from this as well, because you can essentially turn that switch back on up to Union Valley and get power throughout. This is the most expensive approach, and in 2015, the outage time would have been either zero or just a few hours for firefighting efforts if requested. So approach two is really the same approach, but to only go to Chelan Substation, which has a little over 1,000 customers, 1,100 customers. It's 2.7 miles and 22 structures, and it's kind of a middle-of-the-road expense. 2015 fire impact, in this particular case, the fire would have been the same thing, probably zero outage time, because it just so happened that the structures that were burned were in the red section that would be replaced here. There still is, though, the risk in that upper section of it being where they're parallel. A fire could go through there and cause the same problems. And approach number three is really to only replace critical structures with steel. So these are hard-to-reach structures, angled, heavy-angled structures, dead-end structures. It's kind of an approach that tries to lessen the length of an outage. There's still wood structures throughout there, but it would potentially lessen the outage time. And in this proposal, there's 21 structures replaced, and this is the lowest cost option. And had this been in place during the 2015 fires, it's likely there still would have been an outage, but less time. And, of course, approach four, there's do nothing. We can just leave the system as it is. No project-related costs. The poles are not at their end of life. This line went in the late 70s, and we get 60-plus years, generally, out of our wood transmission lines. And there would be no reliability improvements, though, to the system, obviously. So kind of comparing approaches, again, there's the number of customers directly benefited. That's kind of from that direct steel, where you absolutely are not going to have a structure burn down to that substation. So option one is 3,500, option two is 1,100, and option three really didn't have a direct benefit to any of them. Potential downtime reduction, I've kind of discussed these already in the first option, would have been none to maybe several hours. Same with option two in this particular case, but there is that other vulnerability. And option three, anytime there's a structure outage, there's kind of a certain amount of time that it just takes to get a response out there, to get out to the yard and get the parts, to get the line crews assembled. So even if only one structure burned or six structures burned, we get five or six crews out there. It still takes that same amount of time to get to the yard and get the parts and get out there, and then multiple crews can go to work to replace. So the time doesn't change quite as drastically as it
Steve, let me just clarify that. Option three would benefit the 3,500 customers, but just a much shorter number of hours in terms of reduced outage time. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Just so that it's clear for the board that zero is...
Yeah. Well, option two and three both would do that, wouldn't it?
No, two actually, as I understand it, would benefit the 1,000 customers and pretty much eliminate the outage risk. Three, because you're only... taking out some of the poles, you're still, some may burn through.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to be able to repair quickly. So you get the full benefit to the 3,500 customers,
right? So,
and actually, Chad says not sure. So let me just.
Yeah. Well, so I think at least the way we try to, count it here was steel transmission line directly to a substation. To come up with the customers directly benefited. I think what you're saying about really the 8,500 customers up there are all benefited by, you know, option three or two or one. It's just that the sum of them, I think, have a, if you have a steel transmission line directly to a substation, there's, I think you can correlate the benefit more directly, if that helps at all.
But ultimately, the entire area would have a reduced outage time any of those options because of what it's, the assistance it's providing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So our next steps really, oh, go ahead.
I just had a question. Was there an analysis done to look at steel lines from Chelan to Union Valley and not down to Chelan Falls? Because it seems to me whenever I hear about fires, they're always in Union Valley. And I know you're comparing it to 2015, but historically, Union Valley tends to catch fire frequently.
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question directly.
Did we? I think in the approaches we looked at, we didn't look at that one where we're rebuilding just the line between Chelan and Union Valley.
Oh, I see.
Think when we looked at the, here we go, this fire risk assessment, and I'm not the local, definitely not the familiar with local fire history in Chelan, but when we look at our fire risk assessment that we did perform up there, it seems to indicate that the, at least the risk of, and the way the fire risk assessment worked was it looked at really fire intensity. So the color of those dots, the higher it is the more intense the fire is that would burn there if one started. So the really that area two that Steve was talking about was part of our thinking for that. But I mean, I think with Chelan, Union Valley, I mean, there's a lot of different approaches you could take to talk about this.
Yeah. Now the outages in Union Valley, because I think there are a number of reported seem to be on the distribution lines rather than the transmission. You know, so I'm not sure that. The transmission lines would maybe affect that, but it would certainly take the big dog out of the fight.
Yes, mm-hmm. There was a lot of damage, sorry, Chad, to the distribution system during that time as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. This, when the backbone is gone, everything's
right.
Just gone.
Yeah, everything's
gone. Yep. So I guess, you know, recognizing the input you want from us, one of the questions I had in my mind coming in, we're looking at one portion of Chelan County because it burned a couple of years ago. Did we look at the entire county and say, where is our worst risk throughout the county? Or did we just isolate it and look at one section?
As part of the fire risk assessment that we did, that did look at the entire county. And there's really a couple of areas that popped up. One is Chelan, another one is Lake Wenatchee Plain area that's certainly more significant and will take us longer to get our arms around that area.
Is it a higher risk?
In terms of the number of red dots, yes, it's a higher risk. It's also much more costly, at least the things that we've identified so far.
We're looking at 8,500 customers here, Lake Wenatchee area.
Plain is 3,500,
somewhere
I want to say.
Okay. Yeah. Significant numbers. Mm-hmm. All right.
So we're not giving up on Lake Wenatchee Plain.
No.
It's just that the difficulty of actually putting in place the fix there will take us many more years.
Because
of the challenges of working with particularly the federal land managers.
So I guess my question was predicated on, I want to look at the whole picture before I look at a segment of the picture.
Actually, we did do that, and we had a presentation for the board a year or two ago. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So we can just send that back to you and show you that we went
through. Yeah.
It was actually one of the first times this type of work has been done, and it's been interesting because HDR has been able to use this in conferences and other places to kind of describe this as a way of approaching this that is new to our industry.
I guess this comes back to how we look at any project, whether it's, you know, a district socialized cost project versus some other type of project.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important consideration.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's why it's taken us so long, because this came out of the strategic plan with customers saying this is important. Now, 3 years later, the reason for the 3 years is because we went through that risk assessment process to try to figure out where in the county should be our priorities.
Commissioners, your thoughts? Commissioner Congdon, thoughts?
Dennis, thank you. I'm just walking into the doctor's office.
Okay.
But, good discussion.
Thank you.
So from your standpoint, then the next step is to go out, have customer interaction, get feedback.
Yeah, I certainly think so. I think, especially in the Chelan area, we've been thinking, Suzanne's been helping us think, try to schedule a, if it's the right next step, a meeting with the Chelan City Council and really gauge what the community reaction to something like this might be.
Our concern, candidly, is anytime we touch poles up in Chelan, it seems to be controversial. So we want to check in and see, hey, we've got something here that we think could provide a benefit. In fact, we're confident could provide a benefit in terms of reliability benefit. But we don't want to just do that. We want people to see the choice and the trade-off. And if they're not interested, then and they would prefer to live with the existing reliability they've got, then that's okay.
So would you review with me the trade-off that we're talking about there? Because I guess I'm not completely sure. If the poles are within inches of the same height, steel versus wood, what's the trade-off there?
I think if you go back to that picture that Steve put up, you can see that from an aesthetic standpoint, it's probably not much. But I suspect that people, if they hear that we're doing something, may assume the worst. So this is the reason for the outreach, is to be able to show them this is the trade-off. It looks pretty small to us. Mm-hmm. And see if they agree.
Yeah.
And it could be that through the engineering analysis as we get further along that some of the poles might need to be a little bit taller than they are now, and they might move a little bit from, you know, where they're at. If you look at the picture on the left right there where there's one right behind the other, right? I mean, it's going to, by and large, look and feel just like it does now, but there will likely be small changes that will be required. Okay.
Dennis, this is Ann.
Yeah, Ann.
I missed some of that. Was that just, that was Chad Bowman speaking?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if later I could, after my appointment, call in and visit with Chad a little bit, because I'm interested in, I just got pieces of that conversation.
Chad is shaking his head in the affirmative, yes.
All right, so I will, I'll call back after the meeting.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Just, I think Chad illustrated it well, but we have learned over a few times that on that picture on the left, if that's out your living room window, depending on what you're looking at, there is a difference there. And people have brought that to our attention. So one of the things that we wanted to be well aware of is that any little changes, as much as we think they're small, could be big, depending on what the people are used to in the view. That could be a window edge right there. That's not even in the view, and then becomes part of the view. So we think it's really important just to make sure we're very clear what we're doing out there, talk to individual customers that might be impacted, understand what those impacts are. Those are some of the trade-offs.
So when you do that and you give them, well, it could be a little bit different, or on this poll, is there going to be clarity shared by unit or by which pole, by as to what's going to be different, what's going to be the same? You're going to be able to have that clarity?
Right. You might want to talk about the process in terms of staking and then making sure customers can see where these poles are going. So I think as we would work through this process and identify which approach we would like to use, so when we rebuilt the McKenzie-Wenatchee tap line, the pictures that are here, at some point in that process, we actually went out and put stakes in the ground. The new pole is going to be here, and it's going to be this tall. And that allowed the landowners that were immediately adjacent to that could go say, oh, well, I either don't care, or I like this, or I don't like this. And in a few cases, there were maybe two or three individuals that we worked with to make some minor tweaks to the location of structures to better accommodate their needs. Not saying that we could do that in every case, but it was certainly our hope, though, is going into it.
You're saying the height will be within, quote, inches.
Well, I think it could be, I wouldn't say inches, I would say 5 to 10 feet, perhaps, but not at all locations. And I just say that because we haven't done the engineering yet. Okay. And until we do the engineering, you know, I can't say with any certainty that they will all be the same. I think most of them will be the same, but there will probably be a few that, for whatever reason, need to be a little bit taller.
So I think the question is there a head nod to move ahead, forward? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the details will emerge if given the opportunity to move ahead. So I would ask the commissioners to, you know, share, you know, with our staff your thoughts in terms of worthy project, keep moving, good time to end it.
I think we did identify as a strategic plan, you know, the fire hardening as part of the process. We've got a couple areas that are identified, and it's good to know that we've done that analysis and we're going to be looking at the county as a whole.
Other commissioner thoughts?
I think it has great value to continue moving forward. My only concern or advice would be that prior to outreach, you have a much clearer sense of each pole, that if we've had some experiences where the height of a pole was raised, and that created a great deal of problems. And so as an outreach, we need to be very clear on those poles that will change materially. Mm-hmm. Within inches is one thing, within feet is another, and be able to vocalize that to residents of the area before we move forward.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to understand that there was some angst here, but when we extended the Alcoa line through Douglas County, there was some concern, but it was the amendments were done basically privately in living rooms, and people ended up pretty happy. You know, so I'm just saying location, 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 but, you know, I would concur with Commissioner Smith, and I think it's worthy, and I think we need to move forward.
We did the same type of outreach, commissioners, sometime ago with the Eastmont Extension, and we had to move some poles associated with that, and we're really successful working with customers and able to resolve their concerns. The biggest, I think they appreciated being asked, and then we had the opportunity to explain what we could do and what we couldn't do, and it made for a better outcome, I think.
Do you have enough information?
I think so. Thank you.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good presentation.
Good presentation, yeah.
Thank you,
Steve. Okay. All right, next up, there was a question asked at the last meeting as a result of public comment about the previous analysis we'd done on the service center headquarters facility and the question about looking at raising the buildings here and trying to rebuild here. So Dan Frazier has resurrected the old analysis. Not even sure if it occurred before he got here. It might have.
I personally was involved.
Okay, good. All right. Yeah. And he's got a presentation just to inform the board about what that analysis was.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. So I'd just like to take you back on a couple different presentations that we did. Again, this was over a long period. This has been going on for nearly 3 years. And really looking back at our approach and then what that approach yielded as we go through planning processes, we learn things, and they tend to make our approach change over time because what we've learned influences the direction we go. So the initial conversation that actually happened in this room almost 3 years ago talked about what we'd like to do in terms of all three of the scopes. We had the Rock Island, the Rocky Reach, and the Headquarters Operations Center piece. And they all kind of followed the same three-scenario approach, which was short-term strategies was the what could we do just to take our maintenance, what we do on an annual basis, and maybe lump that together and try to approach it in terms of let's do a bunch at once and see if we can get some bang for the buck. And this was on the heels of a study that said we're going to spend this much over time. And the question was, is there a better way to do it? So this was one approach, is to try to front load that work into a beginning. A scenario two, which was the stay where we are, but reinvest for the long term. It was the 50-year approach, but it was a 50-year approach on our current facility. So that was scenario two. And then scenario three was, is there a way we can consolidate our operations? And the scenario three for the operations service and headquarter piece was simply an operations center only question. During that first initial meeting, we got the feedback of, well, should we look at what a full consolidation would be? So that was the first time that the scope and the scenarios tended to change a little bit, as we added that scenario four, which was a full consolidation. So that was the first change. As we went through the process, what we found was scenario one really wasn't what we call a base case or a status quo. It was more of a reactionary, not very far-sighted. It was even hard to model in the long term. So we came up with what we called scenario zero later, which was our base case. And I'll get through the numbers on those. But the real question was around scenario two. And this is the one that early on we said, this is going to have some long-term implications just in trying to implement a plan like this. And so this is the Fifth Street campus. And if you see all the red dash buildings, those were current buildings are. And so those buildings would be taken down. So over time, to make this site work for us, we had to increase square footage and increase, we don't have any more land, so we had to go up with certain things and really revision the site. So to do that, you have to move operations off the site, do your work, build a new facility, bring them back, move somebody else off the site, and do the same thing repeatedly. It was about an 8 to 10 year implementation to do, and it actually had the highest cost of all of the options we looked at. And part of that was just that logistics piece. How do we have to lease ground, or do we buy something, all those different things in order to make that happen? So this one was shown as probably not the most cost-effective way to look at a long-term facility plan. But we did keep looking at what could we do in terms of a split facility where we did operations out in the north area and keep a headquarters or administrative piece back. And so this is the first map of this this campus. And then we also would have to do the same thing at Holly Street. So we had a little less impactful. You keep the lot the same. But a lot of building moves, if you see all those red dash lines, those are all buildings that would go away. So a lot of logistics and difficulty in trying to keep operating and stay on the site and work toward the 50-year view on this site. So these were that attempt to figure out what we would do there. However, when we got into the actual evaluations, the scenario two there was the most expensive option. And we created the scenario zero. The scenario one fell out pretty quickly because it wasn't something that was a long-term value. But scenario zero was the status quo. And so what we tried to do is model how we would move forward and meet our needs, but in a reactionary approach instead of in a proactive perspective. And so what you see in this is the August 2016 evaluation. So it's been 2 years since this information came out. Scenario two was shown to be the highest cost in a net present value. And so as we move forward on the qualitative pieces, it also had a hard time meeting a lot of our qualitative aspects in terms of optimizing service levels. You're still separated in terms of what's on this campus and what's on the Holly Street campus, so you don't get that synergy of the two groups together. It also had it had the ability to increase safety, but not to the level of a new facility where you're designing around a new location and your operations are around rethinking the whole campus. So for several reasons, this option fell off the evaluation at this point. And so then we went forward with the scenario zero and then the scenario three and scenario four. See if I can. Oh, there's some notes there. And that's where we ended up with. These were the final evaluations in March of 17, so just a little over a year ago. And this is what we brought in. You see the numbers changed a little bit. The scenario four came down a little bit as we continued to refine. But all of the changes that happened actually, we would look back and see, is an assumption we made going to affect some of the scenarios that we have that we didn't bring forward? And most of them continued to create a larger gap between where we were heading with scenario three and four and scenario two. So it wasn't that we eliminated an option and then just forgot about changes to our evaluation. Kept looking back. to make sure. But so this is where we ended up a little over a year ago in terms of what are the scenarios that we want to move forward to the next level. And scenario zero continued to be that reactive approach. The scenario three was the what we called the split facility. So we put a an operations and service center out at the old station north area and kept the headquarters piece here for a period of time and then eventually did consolidate out in the old station area. And scenario four was to do it all at once at the same time. You can tell on the qualitative pieces, it still it checked those boxes. And that's a lot of what we try to do here is set out our goals and then see how our options hit those goals. And the consolidated facilities not only hit the financial goal, but it also hit all the qualitative goals about productivity, about cost predictability, definitely safety, and the way that we respond to our customers. That this was why we moved forward with this scenario four option as the consolidation. One of the things that we couldn't really develop in the scenario three was how would we really break the organization effectively. We had a lot of conversations about adjacency. So that customer service piece is probably the piece that's most affected by the adjacencies. We have customer service engineers that would need to meet with the public. And if they're downtown, because we are customer-facing pieces downtown, they're definitely separated from the people they work with to affect the work, which is the line crews and the foreman and the superintendents. And so we really spent a lot of time thinking about how would scenario three affect our operations, especially the distribution and fiber operations. How do those function, and how would we artificially pull them apart in a way that we've, to this point, said they need to be at least in the same campus? So scenario three hadn't really solved all those options, and if we did pursue that with a operations and service center first, we would have to figure out the best way to do that, because I think it was shown through our analysis that scenario four or the consolidation really hit all those boxes. So that's the process we went through over about a 2.5 year period through the numbers and coming up with this was the options that we move forward to the final for these three options. Oops, any questions about that?
Comments, questions? Good review.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for refreshing my memory on all that.
I had to refresh mine.
Okay, next up, I want to invite our finance team to do an update on the debt ratio target.
Good morning. So for the record, I'm Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial Risk Officer. Joining me is Heather Ireland, Lead Treasury Analyst. And then also joining from the crowd is Debbie Litchfield, our Treasurer. And we are here today to give you an update on our debt ratio target, but we would like to keep you in suspense for just a moment.
So first, we'd like to have you remember back to the 2010 timeframe and think about where we were at then. We were going through a significant economic downturn, something that affected the whole nation and world. For the district specifically, we were operating under old power contracts, which meant that our surplus power sales were smaller than they are today. And we also were required to bond for most of our capital projects. That led to show this, a debt balance that was over $1 billion, a board right here. If I can do this. I know. We tried to do this.
No, no. Could be our own Vanna Weiss, not you, Randy.
Oh, there we go.
You're right.
Oh, thank you. Our customers were expressing concern over that debt balance. We heard that through customer surveys. And in addition, the rating agencies were also expressing concern that a AA-rated utility would have such high debt leverage. those items influenced us as we did our financial planning for the 2010 through 2014 timeframe, and helped us establish targets that would strengthen our financial condition over time. As you can see, from back then, there was a lot of yellow on the board. It meant that those targets, even the forecasts, showed that we would have to take some actions in order to meet those targets, including the achieving a debt leverage ratio of less than 60% by 2014. We did take action to meet that target. We did practice. Some of those actions included things like refinancing a large portion of our debt and also planning to use some of the new contract power sales elements that went into effect in 2011 and 2012 to do some pay-as-you-go capital.
So our focus continued during strategic planning for 2015 through 2019. And during that time, our customers again expressed a concern with our debt levels. So our goals at that time included reducing debt. I think we even used the word significantly reducing debt, and achieving a debt ratio of less than 35% by 2019. So at that time, after setting these goals, we embarked on our debt reduction program, where we utilized cash reserves to pay down debt at the earliest call dates. And we did adjust our plans here and there along the way, responding to conditions at hand, but we were always keeping our eye on path of achieving that debt ratio. We have been reporting that forecasts showed that we may achieve that target a little early, and we even foreshadowed in our Q2 financial update last meeting about this target. So we're very happy to be here today to report that as of July 2018, we have achieved our goal with a debt ratio of 34.8%. And we expect it to be maybe even a little bit lower at year end because we have one more minor principal payment to make. So this has been 8 years of hard work to achieve this very important goal. Having a lower debt payment is beneficial for our customers because it enables us to be more resilient and respond better to unexpected events. And then in turn, that helps us keep our utility rates low. So just like in your personal life, if your mortgage payment is lower, it's a lot easier to adjust and handle unexpected events. Something like both of your kids' cars breaking down at the same time. It just happened to me. The same goes for the district. Having less debt gives us the flexibility to meet challenges such as paying for repairs of our aging turbines and generators or managing through low wholesale prices. The rating agencies have also recognized the positive progress, and we are now rated AA+ by both Fitch and S&P. So it's taken discipline and commitment across the district to reach this goal. Our customer owners asked us to reduce debt and strengthen our finances. And with your leadership and the focus of all employees, we have. So together, we did it. Yeah. And this was old school.
You got to go on the road with that show, though.
We need a little transition practice. Yeah. On the road.
No, the old tech kind of refreshing. But thank you very much, and commendable for the effort, the discipline. At one point, this was the only topic in town, and people are now like, "Oh, really?" You know. So it's a great success story, and certainly worth telling. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm just, as the new commissioner, I'm just, you know, I wasn't here part of this, but this has been an exciting story
to see the work that's gone into this over years and years and years, the leadership, and I am just really impressed. In fact, I am so impressed, I brought lemon zucchini cake to celebrate this. It is out in the hallway. There are three cakes out there, and it's just my efforts to say thank you for all of your hard work and everybody in this organization. This is, to me, this is a big, big deal, and I really appreciate this. And am inspired that when you have a vision and you clarify it and you work towards it, and you see the benefit in the other parts of your organization, it's just spectacular to have such a great vision. And I commend this board for their work and the manager and the leadership to get to the point of reaching that goal. It's a big deal. Enjoy the lemon cake.
I want to propose we do more reporting like that if you're going to.
Brad, right? And good looking lemon cake.
I've never heard of lemon zucchini.
I saw it out there, but it wasn't open. So I.
Hey Kelly, do you have the number, the 34.8%? What is the actual dollar?
500 and what million?
By the end of the year, it will be 513.5 million.
Okay.
So we have one more small payment to make, and we'll be there.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you, yeah.
Great job.
Great job.
Yeah.
This topic used to be worth 5 to 15 emails a week. I'm serious. I'm serious. Thank you.
Commissioners, we have a couple minutes. If you wouldn't mind, I'd love to knock off a couple of our manager items.
Sure.
I want to invite Jeff Osborne up. He's ready to talk a little bit about whitewater boating in Chelan Gorge for this year, which will be a challenge because of the sloughing problem that we've described to you before.
Good morning. Jeff Osborne, Senior License Compliance Specialist. I'm even lower tech. I just have a sheet of paper. So. But yes, just want to provide notification that we will be suspending the whitewater boating event that is scheduled for the third weekend of September. I believe that's the 15th and 16th. Public safety concern, clearly, because of the sloughing that's been identified in what we call Reach 2, that very steep section. I believe you've had a briefing on that. Mm-hmm. If not, there'll be more to come. But we have commissioned a development of an emergency action plan in the event of some type of catastrophic failure. That should be out this fall, collecting additional information. I mean, it's, I guess you could say, calving, you know, large rocks and boulders on a regular basis. We've suspended our fisheries research. We do snorkel surveys in the Chelan River. Have not been doing that for 2 or 3 years, actually probably more like 4 years because of safety issues. We have had conversations with Tom O'Keefe, who is the regional director of American Whitewater, and expressed our concern, and he's in support of developing the emergency action plan, collecting some additional information, and suspending the boating for this year. Because it is a license requirement, he's interested in having further discussions with district staff about some what-ifs. Are there any alternatives in the future, potential put-ins below that area, which I don't know if you're familiar with that area. Daybreak Canyon is near the kind of outlook overlook where you can look down in the gorge. It's very, very steep to get in there. It's probably doable, but again, things that we're going to be looking at obviously are public safety and safety of the boaters. So we have a filing to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We'll try to get that to them this week, but I've been in contact with Washington, D.C. Again, the concern of public safety is a higher priority with implementing license measures. So FERC is in, the commission is in support of us pursuing this. So I think we've covered all our bases. I'm going to work with Suzanne and Kimberly and get something out to the public, but wanted to inform the board first before we move forward with anything. So any questions?
So the sloughing area is actually where they were putting in the boats?
They're actually putting in up by the old sewage treatment plant, which is in what we call Reach 1, which is kind of that broad, flat section. Mm-hmm. Then it goes around a corner into a very steep, narrow section, which is Reach 2, and that's where the sloughing is occurring. There's an old sludge field up there. You can't really see it, but during some inquisitions about trails in that area, I don't remember what the group was that wanted to put a trail up there. I mean, this is something that we've noticed for years. Bill Christman has, and Gene Yao have been keeping an eye on this for many, many, many years. It's active, but in the investigation of where this trail was proposed, we had folks out and saw that it was much, much more aggressive than what we had thought originally. So it's very, very much a concern about materials continuing to come down the hill and a potentially a catastrophic event. Who knows, you know, when that might occur. Thank you. Just want to make sure that we're aware and keeping people safe.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Good to see you.
So I've got some backup support on this in case you have questions, but just a quick update on pole attachment rates. You know, we've talked about that in the past, and we have put information out for public comment. We had at one time thought we would be reviewing that here at this meeting. We did receive some public comment, particularly some pretty significant detailed comments from Charter. So we want to take some time just to make sure that we thoughtfully analyze those before we bring them back and have a conversation with the board about that. Charter had thought that maybe we were going to bring that up today. So they have reiterated they wanted to make sure the board is aware of their public comments. We'll be sharing the comment letter that we got from Charter with the board as one of our follow-up action items. We had just heard from them this morning about that. Interestingly enough, their comment letter, you may recall our rates roughly in the $11 range, and we had proposed to going to about $29. Their comment letter objects to many things, but concludes that with their approach, it would be more like a $22 rate. So there's a difference between us, but the idea that their rate would increase, at least so far with the comment we received, is not in question. Okay. Fair enough?
Yep, good.
So more to come in a future meeting on that subject. We have a moment, and I'm actually out of having the right people in the room to do manager items. I thought if I might, I might just go through the delegation of action items.
Sure.
Knock that one out. We had three from the last couple of meetings, all of which are now completed. The first was the analysis on the headquarters facilities and looking at the raising and starting over option, which you just heard. The second was looking at the cryptocurrency applications, how many are pending that were below 50 kilowatts. And Eric forwarded some information from Lindsay Mons following the last meeting. Hopefully you've seen that. And the third was one that you wouldn't have seen yet, but was sent to you just this morning, right prior to the meeting, and that was the map of PUD-owned properties. So it's an email from Felicity Saberhagen. It's coming in electronic form because, as you might guess, we have some really, really small properties on a map. They don't show up. So at least now, if you get it electronically, you're able to blow it up into whatever size you want to determine the level of detail that you'd like to have.
Thank you. I did see that arrive, but I didn't open it yet. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And those were the three that I've got from there. And with that, I think we've completed the things that we can complete this morning in advance of the hearing this afternoon.
Hearing at 1 o'clock. So, commissioners, anything before we break? Hearing none, we will adjourn until our hearing at 1 o'clock. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Board of Directors meeting for Chelan County PUD. And we have three commissioners present. And is Commissioner Congdon not yet on the phone? Okay. So we have a quorum, and we will begin with a hearing related to cryptocurrency moratorium. Mr. Wright.
So what we would like to do is make a presentation. Couple things that we want to do today. First, we want to describe what we heard at the last public hearing, because our responsibility as a public agency is to listen to public comment, make sure that we're thinking it through and addressing it. So main thing we want to do with the board today is just describe to you what we as staff heard from that hearing, and therefore the things that we're working on, and candidly the things that we're not working on, because there are issues that we didn't hear very much about. In fact, in some cases, heard nothing about. And so we're presuming that we're on course with those, because nothing has changed relative to what we presented to the board, and the board has told us seems like a good direction and didn't hear anything in the public comment. So that's our purpose today, is really a conversation with the board about where we think we are. And I will just tell you that we're, based on what we've heard so far, relatively optimistic that we're getting close to being able to put a proposal out that would then lead to a rates process. So it's not like we're going to be done soon, but we would at least be done with this policy work that will allow us to then proceed with a rate proposal. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lindsay.
Yeah. And when you finish, let me give a few instructions for our community input, which we would encourage.
Do you want to start with that?
I could do that. Oh. There will probably be, I anticipate, you know, community input, and you're welcome to do so. And what I'd like us to do is to take about, 4 minutes per person to, you know, have an initial round. And then if, time permitting, and I believe it would be, that there could be, you know, additional rounds of the community input. What we want to do is ensure that people have the opportunity to express themselves in a civil and, quality format and with a time frame that allows other people to have their opportunity to speak. And with that, I think that's probably more than enough instructions. So thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you, Dennis. Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Lindsay Mons. I'm the business manager in our customer utilities group. So today's discussion is a continuation of our hearing from August 6th. In the last couple of weeks, staff has gone over public comment and considered that information that we heard from all of our customers at that meeting that spoke. And based on that, today we'll provide some additional information on the rate considerations for the next discussion, and then provide an opportunity for public comment as well. So during the public comment periods, both at this past hearing and the prior hearing, this is a summary of some of the things that we've heard. From our existing non-cryptocurrency customers, it's a tongue twister, we've heard pretty consistently that those customers would like us to avoid shifting costs. So what that means is that customers associated with the new group of business or service should not impact rates of other customers. From the cryptocurrency existing operators and those interested in operating in our area, we've heard that they'd like us to allow this new technology a chance to succeed, so not to put up unnecessary roadblocks in that arena. We've heard that the volatility of market rates, which we've presented, is of particular concern for small operators and their ability to plan, and that the impact of the new rate is significant for those established miners who maybe set their business plans on a previous rate before we put the moratorium into effect. Customers have requested that we consider phase-in approaches for the new rates to limit that impact. And then from the larger operators, we've actually heard that the market variability of the rate is reasonable, considering the impact to the district, but that going forward, customers need to be able to have some reasonable expectations of the future rate so they can make their business plans. And based on that, we've had no other opposition as far as the rates go for the larger loads. It's mainly in the small residential, small commercial area that we've gotten comment on the information provided so far. So first, this slide is one that we've talked about at the hearing before, but the screens out at the CTC were very difficult to read, so I've provided it again today in an easier-to-read format. And the basis of this, or the basic conclusion of this slide, is that for our large operators over a megawatt, what we see in the market right now, we're forecasting an effective rate in the 5.5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour. So based on current market conditions or the past 24 months or so. For the residential services, however, we're anticipating that could be higher in the 7 to 10 cents per kilowatt hour, depending on how those customers use energy, if they're a combined cryptocurrency and residential in the same service point. So for the residential services in particular and the small commercial, we are continuing to evaluate this rate with that in mind. We heard customer comment there, and we are listening to you. So of this rate, the most significant portion is the energy. So the breakdown of the rate, estimated rate, we charge or bill in three-part rates. The first part is a basic charge, which comprises generally your customer service, billing, metering, those types of things. And there's additional information in the appendix to the presentation that really describes what each of these charges cover. I'm going to pause here for just a second while we get some chairs figured out in the room. See, there's one open chair over here and a couple moved in here if you guys want to. All right, so basic charge element of our rate covers metering, billing, that sort of thing. With our existing customers, the cost of service for cryptocurrency customers is coming in around $900 a month. This does not differentiate between large and small customers at this time. However, we are continuing to evaluate this for small customers. But also keeping in mind that in most cases, the smaller customers tend to take more customer service time than the larger. So we are taking those things into account when we look at this basic charge. The delivery charge portion of the rate is intended to cover primarily the transmission and distribution systems, so how the power gets to the customer. And through the HDL effort, we put in a rate of $5.50 per kilowatt per month, and that is remaining the same for the larger commercial industrial customers here, so there's no change in that. However, for the smaller and the residential services, our cost of service is showing two to three times higher than this amount. When we did the HDL effort the time before, we had no residential HDL, so we did not include that in our evaluation. So when we look at that now, this is the cost that we're seeing on our system, continuing to evaluate that as well. And then the energy charge portion, which totals about 5.1 cents per kilowatt hour, is the most significant portion of the rate. And based on our current forward market price indicators, we have some estimated breakdown of that energy rate and where the different elements come from. So first is the market energy, forecasted at 2.6 cents per kilowatt hour. And this is the most significant variable portion of this rate, where market changes would cause this number to go up or down. We also have an estimated specified source or carbon-free premium, which means an additional 0.4 cents to provide green power to these customers. Ancillary services and other charges at 0.8 cents, and our estimated risk premium of 1.3 cents per kilowatt hour. So with all that in mind and the comments that we've heard from our customers, our plans going forward are in response to that public comment to evaluate and update our rate proposals for the small customers, so those less than a megawatt, that address those concerns regarding the impact of the high basic charges as well as the variable energy rates, and also to consider development of phase-in options. At a future meeting, we'd also bring forth a rate outreach plan. These sort of plans, for those of you who weren't involved in the last time around, cover things like our informational meetings, rate hearings, rate testing periods, and effective dates. So it wouldn't be an immediate effective rate. We do have a process that we would go through, and that would be a proposal to the board with timelines for your approval. Also underway, which we may or may not have an update for at the next meeting, are our efforts engaging with the cities and counties on their particular zoning and other efforts as far as cryptocurrency goes. So we are actively collecting information in that area as well. So that's what I have for you today on staff's effort in the last couple weeks. If the board has questions, I'll take those. Otherwise, we can move to public comment.
I do. Steve?
Comments? No. Okay. No comments from the commission at this point, so if there's any additional staff comments, then let me open it up to the public, and I would encourage you to use the handheld microphone, introduce yourself, first, last name, and your current address. because our meetings are recorded, and the public likes to know who's speaking and where they're from. So at this point, please address the commission if you would choose to do so.
Come on up.
Please, come on up. And welcome back.
Nick Martini at 324 South Chelan in Wenatchee. So first of all, I just wanted to thank you, you know, for the progress that's been made. I appreciate that, and I hope it continues. My concern has to do with the residential rate. So I'm looking at the schedule here, and it looks like it's still something that people are investigating and trying to figure out. But, you know, the 7 to 10 cents rate, I intentionally targeted a property that was not in a residential area. It was in an area that is zoned for cryptocurrency mining. And it costs a little bit more than I would have paid for a regular residential property, but there are residences around my property. My concern is that even though I'm in a zone for cryptocurrency mining, that because there are people who have residences around me, that might be characterized as, you know, this residential service. And, you know, what I was hoping is that the staff and the commission would sort of consider that, you know, the city has created specific zones for cryptocurrency mining, and take that into consideration when deciding what is a residential service. To me, it seems like this would be more along the lines of someone bought a house and they decided to start doing cryptocurrency mining in the basement, you know, small scale. That's not really what they were supposed to do, but they're allowed to have a small load, and they get charged a little bit more. What I'm hoping is that, you know, my plan and my attempt doesn't get ensnared in that sort of rate classification. And it's particularly, I mean, so I come from the San Francisco Bay Area, and that's served by not a public utility, a private for-profit, well, I don't know if it's private, it's a for-profit utility called Pacific Gas and Electric. And so before I came up here, I did a lot of research about, okay, can I do this in my own backyard instead of making this move? And they have an extremely complicated schedule for this sort of service. You know, there's peak season, there's off season, there's peak hours, there's partial peak hours, there's non-peak hours. But basically, you know, I did my own calculations, and I figured if you have one machine running every second of every day of the year, and then you average it out, my calculations were it came out to about 8.5 cents per hour, or per kilowatt hour. And so if I did move up here and create this, and then I get lumped in with the residential services, and it's 7 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour, I've made the move and taken this risk and end up actually paying more than I would with a for-profit utility in one of the most expensive markets in the country. So I'm hoping to avoid that scenario, but I just thought I'd bring that up as my concern.
All right. Appreciate Thank you. It, Nick, very much.
Thank you.
keep it close.
What?
Yeah, keep it close.
Okay. Yes, I'm a residential cryptocurrency miner.
Could you tell us who you are?
I'm Becky Peters, and I live at 456 Low Street.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm a residential cryptocurrency miner, and I'm currently paying Schedule 35 rates. And I have my miners and my household running on this power. So if we were to adopt the proposed rates here in the county, I think it was 7 to 10 cents or something like that for my miners and my household, then I would be forced out of business. So I'm coming to these meetings each week wondering if I'm going to be able to keep the lights on for another day, because these rates would put me right out of business. And I'm just a hobbyist, but still I have to look at the bottom line and see that I'm not paying more for electricity than I'm bringing in cryptocurrency. So I hope you'll consider the miners that are paying for the mine and the household on the Schedule 35. And also remember that you had a moratorium, and then you came up with a rate. And that's really what I did my business plan based on, and I didn't know that another moratorium would come along 6 weeks after they put in my power, and it did. And I wonder, when I look at around, is there any guarantee that there won't be another change in 2 years? Not really. So that's all.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Morning. Roberto Campo, 1244 Submission here in Wenatchee. So I moved here, even though my family has been living here for 20 years. I think I told already that story. So I moved here because cryptocurrency with my family from Mexico 5 years ago. Now that this is impacting the increase, but the big old picture is with these rates will put me as a resident here in Wenatchee now to even worse conditions than any other place in the U.S. with these new rates. Why would I move over here if I thought that it was going to be happening? It's even expensier than Miami now at these rates. And, I mean, we have resources, natural resources to use better or to produce better electricity. And with these new rates, it will get me as her out of the game. And even though I'm talking about less than 50 kilowatts, I don't know if in a bigger area will be, or a bigger number of consumption of power will be that impact. But I'm just saying that.
Okay. Roberto, thank you very much.
Hi there. Tom O'Connell, 12049 Brett's Drive out in Leavenworth. Residential crypto miner, living in a rural residential zoned area. I've got forests surrounding my property outside of city limits of Leavenworth by 20 minutes or so. I'm in the same boat as the last two speakers. I'm using 1.3% of a megawatt. So after the last meeting, I felt we kind of made a good point. I thought I was going to be alone in this with my power draw. But it's nice to see that there are other people that are in this, 1 to 2% of a megawatt range. That we also have our residential load on the same meter. So my residential rate, I am paying that the increased amount for that, and I've been doing that happily this whole time. Structured my business around the original rate that we had after the initial moratorium. And just like the others, if this rate goes up to 7 to 10 cents, I'll be out of business. I'll either be forced to move, or I just won't be able to keep the lights on at all. So, something to consider. These are local citizens. I'm born and raised in the area here. Not some big outside entity that moved in. Just trying to keep my lights on. So,
thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Monroe. I'm at 10090 Main Street in Piscataway. I just want to echo what has already been said by some of the other members. There are a lot of us who are much smaller than the big players who are coming in. I'm at 1.5% of a megawatt. And obviously this has nothing to do with PUD, but the business is struggling significantly, especially with cryptocurrencies being down. Continuous moratoriums don't allow us to grow a little bit just to be able to grow in capacity to meet all of our business needs. So other people have come up here and said that it's good to have some kind of indication of what's going to be coming And I know you guys are doing a lot of work, and we appreciate that work. It's critical for us to be able to plan, to forecast what our business is going to do on a month-to-month basis. And if moratoriums keep getting kicked out or rates keep getting changed or they're variable in nature, it makes it hard for us as business owners to plan. I moved my family here to this area. I'm also from the Bay Area. But there's a knock-on effect of businesses like ours on the smaller side going out of business. The building that I rent from is now going to have to find a new tenant. The businesses that I patronage around Passachon, they're all going to lose my business. So I just want, and I know you guys are mindful of it, but I just want to echo that to the rest of the board, that this does have an impact on families. It does have an impact, a knock-on impact of other businesses in the area. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Jeremy. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Avin Honeysett. I live at 1802 Manhattan Drive in East Wenatchee, Washington. I am a co-chair for a organization which we would like to help people become more aware of all of the issues and allow for some educational resources with blockchain technology. So we're actually going to have a lecture on the 25th of August on blockchain technology at the local library. So please, everybody that's in this room, show up. And I would, again, kind of reiterate some of the things that have been said in terms of, you know, the individual impact of this moratorium is becoming more devastating by the day for the people that have purchased either property, infrastructure, or machines to be able to operate, even in terms of those that, I mean, all these people that I'm referring to have put in applications, they did their due diligence, and now they're under suspension in a way that doesn't seem to necessarily fit their needs. For instance, these are, you know, smaller entities, you know, like we've heard from Jeremy with the 1.5% megawatt and a couple others. I mean, we should really be considering the individual impact of the small miners. And, you know, it should be known, too, you know, there's all these other rippling effects. Rent went up when miners came from the outside area so that they could come and mine here. You know, people that are purchasing, you know, land and building different kinds of buildings, you know, those are all, in effect, we're paying for lumber, we're paying for work. There is some job creation that is available with this. In fact, I am learning all these new, I'm learning a lot about all of this, and it allows me for another opportunity for a career. So these educated individuals, which I think we would all agree the Wenatchee Valley kind of hurts for, are coming to this region, and they're impacting all different kinds of people, myself included. And I hope that it's considered that all of these people are being affected. Another thing, I would like to thank Lindsay Mohan for actually meeting with us at one point and discussing some of the options. We have some very intelligent minds that are part of our group, Blockchange, and we are offering as much information on the ends, on our end, as far as what is required from miners and how we can find a balance between everyone. So I would like to continue making those meetings and reaching out so that we can offer as much information on our side to assist in the PUD's decision-making process. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Any additional comment?
Yes.
Thank you.
The other side of the coin. Jean Poyer, Kashmir, Washington. And I love that sign right there. The best for the most for the longest. And I'm not sure cryptocurrency really counts in that. Blockchain technology, I've come to understand, is incredibly valuable in its ability to do cyber tracking. But in my own opinion, and thank you for public comment, cryptocurrency is just the wrong use of our beautiful, clean hydropower. It is gold when we're transitioning in our society, and we need to transition from fossil fuels to renewable energies. And having clean hydropower for this is gold, like my friend Kurt said last meeting. And it's also really an integral part in the electrification of transportation. So for myself, I'm one of those people that when I get my PUD bill, I look at it. And I look and see how many kilowatts I used because I want to try and make it less. We're in an age when we need to be relying less on power and making it really go farther. So my highest bill, I try to average like $40 a month in the summer. And when I have to turn the heat on in the winter, and I hit up to about $120, $160, I get really concerned. And I look at that and I say, I need to times this four times to be an average paying utility customer. So to me, someone who's very conservation-minded really values our clean green hydropower and wants it used in a proper manner, cryptocurrency just doesn't work for me. And I understand that there's a lot of small home miners, but what is cryptocurrency really benefiting our community? I mean, it's not like Alcoa providing a lot of jobs, a lot of solar panels, and a lot of projects back to the community. It's individuals trying to make money, and I feel as where blockchain might be a benefit to society, cryptocurrency is just a very huge energy-sucking way of doing essential cyber horse gambling. So I not only say, I understand you have to work with them, but I just wish you weren't even here. You know, that's all.
Thank you, Mr. Wright, commissioners, interested members of the community.
Name and address, please.
Oh, my name is Ryan Ochoa.
Thank you, Ryan.
And 1250 North Wenatchee Ave.
Thank you.
Wenatchee, Washington. For the opportunity to speak to you about cryptocurrency mining in Chelan County, I am representing the local community miners today. We are an entrepreneurial group of individuals with various professional skill sets, such as engineers, educators, and leaders. Our group is concerned about the recent developments from the PUD in regards to cryptocurrency mining moratorium and variable wholesale electricity rate changes as it affects our community miners by discouraging them from participating in this new and innovative field. I am in favor of lifting the moratorium for smaller miners who want to participate in blockchain technology as a priority for the current 100 megawatts of available power capacity. I oppose increasing or implementing variable rates for smaller mining farms. The miners I've met are enterprising community members. These individuals reside in the county. They have various professional backgrounds with highly sought skill sets and have great ambition, as so many members of the blockchain community do. Small miners are small businesses. In essence, they are usually the ones maintaining their own equipment to drive revenue and then placing that revenue back into the community where they live. Small miners have hired local contractors for build-outs, invested in real estate and commercial property, such as their larger competitors. Some have relocated their lives and families and jobs to the county, bringing valuable skills to the local workforce. And many have plans to invest in local business opportunities outside of blockchain. Variable rate increases to smaller miners. As the market stands today, along with the dynamics of blockchain mining difficulties, a rate increase and an HDL upfront cost increase would prevent mining profitability for many local miners, sending them to a more competitive market or push profitability so far out that they cannot compete. A small miner operating on a 200-amp service at an 80% load out of his garage would pay $7,000 to $11,000 in upfront costs, bringing his or her electricity rate price of the first year up 0.024 cents per kilowatt, effectively doubling his rate. This is not including the meter charge and demand charges, which are paid regardless of whether he or she uses full capacity or not. Additionally, if a small miner wishes to grow his capacity by relocating to another property, he or she has to pay the upfront cost once again, and even if the relocation is next door or across the street. These policies make it hard on the little guy that is funding himself. I'm in favor of lifting the moratorium for smaller miners who want to participate in blockchain technology because a multitude of small miners using 200, 400 amp service will add significantly more value to the community of Chelan County than 10 large 10 megawatt installations. I am opposed to increasing or implementing variable rates for established small miner farms, residentially and commercially, as this will take away economic opportunities for small miners to establish or grow in Chelan County. To provide sustainable, reliable utility services that enhance the quality of life in Chelan County, I urge you to consider these remarks as it affects smaller miners when deciding your positions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.
My name is Gail McDonough. I live at 1010 Yale in Wenatchee. I am in the opposing party, if you will, in that all the research that I have been able to do on the effects of Bitcoin, and I'd like to separate that from blockchain, but Bitcoin specifically is described by every financial expert going as extremely risky. And the longevity of Bitcoin's survival is even in question. The problem that I am concerned about is that building out infrastructure and the costs of providing the additional power to even small operators with Bitcoin, if in a worst case scenario, Bitcoin fails entirely, who pays for all of this? The operators won't be able to. They'll be broke. I see why people moving into the community is being cited as a plus. It also means that many more services and so forth are going to be needed. And if they leave, again, who pays for these things? I don't see it as an asset to the majority of people in the community that a few, relatively speaking, a few people are going to potentially make a good deal of money before the crash happens. And it is being commonly stated that by financial experts that, and regulatory experts and all kinds of people, that ultimately this is not a viable system. There are no tangible assets to it. There is no security to the system. There has been like $1.2 billion in outright theft using Bitcoin blockchain. It's just, you know, this is a speculative venture, and I can understand that people are highly motivated because the lure of quick profit is always there. But in the long haul, and those of us who have lived here for some time are in it for the long haul. We didn't come here to make money. We came here to live and to participate in the community. And for us, this is a big risk that we didn't ask for. We're not going to benefit from it. And I'm very concerned about the potential impact. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Anyone want a second round? We'll make it 2 minutes this time.
I just need a second. It was on this estimated, Becky Peters, and on the estimated
basic charge of $900. I just wanted to let you know my entire bill for my cryptocurrency, which is Ethereum, not Bitcoin, mostly, is not $900. So this, I'm smaller. We're, some of us are even smaller than this that are paying Schedule 35. All
right. Thank you.
Oh, I just got to say one more thing. When I went to hire an electrician to put in my, after I had the PUD come in and put the Schedule 35 power in the high density, and he told me that they had been totally busy all last summer with cryptocurrency miners, and that they, it's just a great business to be in, to be an electrician, because there's lots of that business going around. So I just thought I'd let you know that contractors are finding this to be bringing the business.
Thank you, Gail. No, Becky. Appreciate it.
Dave Smith, Leavenworth. Like I said last time, last go around when I was here, I'm a little bit larger, obviously, than some of the rest of the small ones, but it would be very much appreciated if my rate would were to stay the same right now. My multiplier for my power is 40. So for the business, one for the house. You might want to invest in some insulation, because my house is pretty good size. And my power bill, the biggest one this last winter, was $85. So, Gail, we pay up front for this. I had to pay for my permit, or not permit, but high density load status beforehand. I had to pay.
Dave, let me stop you a second. You're here to address the commission, not a person in the audience.
Okay.
Thank you.
We had to pay for that up front. You guys required that. And you've been saying that at meetings. I think that that's fair. I do. I'm not complaining about that at all. I already paid to get my power there. If cryptocurrency goes down, I've already paid for that for you guys to get it there. And my bill runs about $1,500 a month to $1,550. And that's with 44 miners. So I think that if we can work out something like we talked about last time, Steve, I know you talked about it a little bit in your wrap-up, and Malachi talked about it, that it would be nice if we can get something set up for the smaller miners, so that those of us that have been, I've had nice high-density load status since November, and those of us that have been here in that period of time, I would appreciate it if we could be recognized as being grandfathered in at a, something besides this much higher rate. And also, moving forward, for the people that are coming in that want to do it new, I can see that it's fair for them to pay an adjusted amount to make sure that the infrastructure is paid for in advance, like you guys want to do, and I concur with that, and move forward that way.
Appreciate it. Dave, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
We're going to hold just a second to get Commissioner Congdon. No, you can go ahead, please.
I'm sorry.
We're just, let me give you. Commissioner Congdon, are you on board with
us? He's going to dial in.
She's going to dial in. So just give us a second to get the fourth commissioner. Sure.
Hello.
And welcome. And we're in second round of comments. And I have a gentleman in front of us who's spoken before and wants to share a little bit more with us. So please go ahead.
Thanks.
Thank you. Roberto Campo from 1244 Submission here in Wenatchee. There is a very big concern in terms of the transmission of the line and transformation of the power. And in order to get the Schedule 35, we pay for transmission. I don't know if that was rated correctly. And we pay for that on, like, in the location I have at 122 Mission Street, North Mission, 68 kilowatts of power. And upfront, pay $190 per kilowatt in transmission of the line cost. And then if I analyze in the concern of trying to make a little of profit out of this service, and I would suggest like in pointing for a concern of people that wants to use less power, if an allow in a small range by doing an investment to PUD of what's like $22,000 and buying at that time in November it was $24,000 for the equipment to use those 68 kilowatts, it's able to make me a monthly bill of $1,700 that I'm be paying every month to PUD, and it's able to make at that current rate pretty close to $3,000 of profit. By changing this rate at the price that has been pointed now, it's just out of the business completely. So by saying this, by putting 8 months of the electricity cost you have on top of what you are already paying, it will get enough money income for a user of $40 to fully pay their bill and even make some extra money out of it. So at the current rate.
Roberto, thanks you. I was going to say, going once, going twice.
I'm sorry. Thank you for letting me say something again here. And again, my name is Aubin. And in terms of, what will be done with the facilities and things like that if Bitcoin takes a tumble, I do appreciate the distinction between blockchain and Bitcoin. Bitcoin is possible because of the technology of blockchain. So blockchain technology has revolutionary opportunities. And in terms of what else could be done with the data centers if everybody that's mining only Bitcoin, which is also pretty, I mean, you want to have multiple investments in order to secure your investments because something might tumble and then you can pick up on your other things. So it'd be rather foolish to do only one thing regardless. But those data centers, the infrastructure that's in place after they're built, they can be utilized for other things. Let's say somebody, loses all their Bitcoin, they need to sell their property, sell their miners, and then you have this shell of a building. That data center has such capabilities that could be utilized for other blockchain technology applications that could, we're looking into things, the expansion into the medical field, other ways to verify, really, it's boundless. You could talk about agriculture or all these other abilities. Let's say that blockchain technology altogether becomes less useful. Virtual reality centers, AI, that's another application for the data centers that are being put into place. And again, out of the pockets of the individuals that are building them. So there's, just to address that kind of risk, it may not be as risky as it seems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don Poyer, and I'm from Cashmere, Washington. Part of my concern with everything I've heard today is that you've got a lot of operators taking a lot of power out of our grid, but they seem to be scattered everywhere in the county. That's stressing the entire system. You're pulling power from everywhere rather than one specific location or one industrial yard, so that when other people or other industries want to come into this area and utilize that power, we're maxed out. Our system's already strained in places that really shouldn't be. Residential areas are getting strained. I think part of that could be controlled with where we allow people to do bit mining. And I think that should be concentrated in an area that's not in our outer cities, farther away from our power source. The closer you put it, the smarter it would be for our community. Think about maybe putting a park down there at the Alcoa facility or something like that. I could see actually giving them a little bit of a rate break if it was in a concentrated area. That would be easier for our people to service. A lot of our grid out there is old, and it's buried in the ground. And as it goes out and has to be repaired, I don't want my crews over here working on the stress system because we're trying to Bitcoin operate over rather than have it constitute an area that would be easy to maintain. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Anyone else? We're kind of at the going once, going twice. Okay, we'll move on with our hearing.
Can I make a couple of quick comments like I've done in... Oh, shoot. I've got the computer that just failed on me, which is too bad because I was trying to make notes. And hopefully I can get this back up. A couple of quick comments based on what we heard today and what we would intend to do with those, and also respond to some of the things we've heard, if that's okay with you.
Please.
So first of all, I think it's helpful that, again, in this hearing, we heard comments from small miners, many of whom are authorized loads, have already been through the system. And I think we took that away from the last hearing as the focus area for additional work. And I think what you heard from Lindsay is that's where we're spending our time right now, is focused on that. So we did not hear something today that created a huge new workload for us. These are things that we had anticipated hearing and have been working on, and hope to be able to bring back some additional information at the September 4th hearing. And our goal is to try to get to, by September 15th, if we can get to an actual proposal that would move into a rates process, which is what Lindsay was describing, where we would also bring the what's the process that we want to use, which the board gets to establish. I do want to make sure that folks know that we are not trying to set this rate to allow people either to mine cost effectively or to put people out of business. Our focus is on cost of service, not whether it allows people to crypto mine or not. We're focused on what's the cost to the utility system, and then making sure that cost is reflected. And in that regard, a couple of things are important to a couple of points to make. Our last commenter made a point that really resonates with us as staff, I would say. There is no question from our perspective that there is an economy of scale associated with service to load. So if loads are spread out in lots of different places, it's generally going to be more expensive for us to serve them than if they locate in one place. It's just simple economics as to economy of scale. And that is the challenge with residential, and that's why you see the residential cost being higher than the non-residential cost, because trying to provide the infrastructure for a variety of different locations that are in a bunch of different places is just more expensive for us than if it's all located in one place. The comment with respect to, well, if I am in one house and then I move into the next house, should I get a break? That's not the way that we are responding. We size our service to the load request that's made to us. And if a second load request comes in, then that generates a new need for service. And so, again, what we're trying to do is tie our costs and the charges to what the actual costs are that we experience on our system. Let me switch now and make another point. A concern for us is that while loads may be small in lots of different places, there can be a cumulative impact of those loads such that they look like they could have an impact on us like a large load. What I mean by that is from the energy component side. So currently, we're at about 13 or so megawatts. So it started to get to a relatively big number. If we have lots of small loads spread around the county, then we have the infrastructure, distribution, and transmission problem. We also have an energy problem, and that we're having to deal with a substantial amount of megawatts. So one of the things that we have worried about is it's not just an issue of, well, it's a bunch of small things, and therefore it doesn't have much financial risk for us. A lot of small things cumulatively can add up to a big number and more cost. And the final point I would want to make is I just have to say to Mr. Martini that we would be interested in seeing data that would show that this proposed rate is more expensive than Pacific Gas and Electric's rates. We're quite familiar with PG&E and Southern California Edison's rates and believe that they are substantially higher. We do not believe this will be the highest rate in the country. We believe this will be a rate more in the middle of what others are paying in other parts of the country from the knowledge that we have. With that, I think those are the comments I wanted to offer, and hopefully cause people to give some more thought, because I know we will have more opportunities for public comment. Just give them some things to think about for future public comment sessions.
With that, that concludes the hearing.
So we do need, commissioners, we do need to take action and continue the moratorium or set the next public hearing. I think if you flip page in your presentation, or maybe if we just poke a button on the computer screen there.
That works.
We've given you just a proposed draft motion that would set the next hearing on this matter so that staff can bring back proposals to you. And if you notice, Steve was ever enthusiastic in his timing, because he said September 15th, which caused me to stop breathing, and it's actually the 17th.
And probably those who were worried that we were going to have a public meeting
on a Saturday.
Well, in that case, I would move that we continue our moratorium and set the next public hearing for the September 17th, 2018 meeting during the board's regular meeting here in the boardroom.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to continue the moratorium to set the next public hearing September 17th, 2018 during the board's regular meeting at the boardroom location. Is there further discussion from the commission? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as proposed signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion is carried. And that concludes our hearing.
Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you.
Should we take a short break to allow the room to clear?
Yeah. Yep.
For those who don't want to stay
we'll
for
take
our regular...
about a 5-minute recess.
The rest of the agenda is exciting too.
Oh well, yeah, we've got a consent agenda coming up. If you guys want to hang out for that. This is Chelan County Board of Directors coming back into session after a brief break. And we're at the moment of our consent agenda. Commissioners, your wishes?
I would move approval of the consent agenda.
Second that.
Been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as presented. Discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Thank you, Ann. Motion is carried. On to the regular agenda. Mr. Wright, item 12.
12, a resolution accepting the proposal of Lighted Construction Incorporated of Spokane Valley, Washington to provide general contractor construction manager GCCM services for the Rock Island and Rocky Reach hydroelectric support facility improvement projects, and to authorize the general manager to enter into contract for said services. Recall that we did a pretty in-depth presentation at the last board meeting about this, and so we're not planning to repeat that. A few things for you, but plan to make this relatively short. So turn it over to Dan and Sam.
Good afternoon, Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services.
Sam Dilley, Project Manager.
So we're here really just to answer any questions that you may have based on our presentation last week, and then bring forward the resolution for your approval. And we do have some numbers that came up that we thought might be good for you to understand where we're talking about in terms of both. This covers both the Rock Island project and potentially the Rocky Reach project, so we brought some numbers for you. Sam will share that.
Sure. During planning last November, we presented the modeling for Rock Island and Rocky Reach. Rock Island, we modeled the cost at $38.7 million to $39.9 million. We are within those budget ranges right now. The GCCM services is $25 million of that. Currently, this year, we're working on construction projects. We have a large building out there and on-site utilities. That represents about $6.2 million of spending. The remainder of that is in construction management and design fees. Rocky Reach were a little less along the way. We estimated that during last year's planning cycle at $40 million to $41.5 million. We're within those budget numbers. We're approaching 0% design. At Rock Island, we're about 50% design, so we know those numbers pretty well. But as we start with Rocky Reach, nothing's changed. We remain within those planned spending ranges.
And I think it's important to understand that this contract's for roughly $220,000, but it sets up a process that could easily lead to, in fact, will likely lead to the expenditures of the $25 million and the $30 million. Right. Different kind of process than we've been through before because we're using this alternative contracting mechanism to take advantage of the efficiencies that we think we get out of that. So just trying to be really clear about how this process is going to work as we go along.
And the resolution itself does have a not to exceed of the 220, as Steve mentioned, without board action. So we would be back for any amendment to this.
Comments, questions, thoughts?
Just a comment. Over the weekend, I was in a conversation with a friend of mine who actually works for one of the competitors of Leidig up in Bellingham, Strider, and who are doing work for us. And with a contract like this, it seems to me what you've got all of the criteria they need to be able to fulfill, but also the reputation. And they got high marks from the competitor as in terms of reputationally. I think that's an important one, very important.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yep. Anything else? All right, I propose that we take Resolutions 12 and 13 together. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Resolution 13 is a resolution rejecting the bid of Voith Hydro Incorporated and accepting the bid of K&N Electric Incorporated of Spokane Valley, Washington, bid 17-76 for Rocky Reach Unit C9 Wicket Gate Modifications. George, welcome.
Good afternoon. George Velasquez, Manager for Rocky Reach Lake Chelan Engineering Project Management Team.
Good afternoon. Tom Beebe. Project manager for Rocky Reach Lake Chelan.
Tom is managing this contract, if approved, and we're here to present a resolution to authorize award for bid 1776. That's for the Rocky Reach Unit C9 Wicket Gate refurbishment. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Tom, and he can speak a little bit about the details.
Okay, so this bid went out the bid on July 6th. We opened up the bids publicly July 31st, received two bids back on this. Our low bidder, Voith Hydro, had two pages of basically clarifications to the district's general conditions and specific requirements. Our legal department reviewed basically their basically clarifications, came up with that these are material, and it's in our best interest to award to K&N Electric out of Spokane, Washington, who still falls in with the engineer's estimate within 1% of it. So we're compliant there. However, with Voith taking their clarification to our bid documents, we basically object to award to the second bidder on this one. So
comments, questions? Hearing none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yep.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Commission, we have two items that need our attention on the regular agenda, 12 and 13. Tell me what it is you'd like to do.
I'd like to move forward with Resolution 12 and 13 as detailed. Do you want me to read that?
No, not necessarily.
I would second that motion.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to accept Resolutions 12 and 13 as presented. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion is carried.
Okay. Ready for some manager items?
You know, I've been anticipating those.
Looking forward to it.
I thought you were done.
Let me start with Dan Fazer and Lance Knudsen. I want to talk a little bit about some recognition that has occurred for Fleet.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks again. Dan Fraser, Director of Shared Services.
Lance Knudsen, Fleet Services.
So what we'd like to do is actually celebrate. It's really all of Chelan PUD we're here to celebrate today. This is a Fleet Award, but it's really the entire agency, the entire team here that participates in bringing this and achieving this success. This 100 Best Fleets is a trade organization that is really based around what do fleets do and how do we serve our customers. So in addition to offering training and how to operate a fleet, how to look for what the best way to serve your customers is, they also provide a competition to make it a, I mean, what's better than a friendly competition. So they started this competition about almost 20 years ago, 18 years ago now, I think. And this is the second time that Wenatchee has been recognized as a top 100 fleet. And so it's Lance is going to tell you kind of the things that go into getting that achievement, but it really is a whole district success in providing this.
So you're measured year over year on 12 different categories, different criteria that they set up within the contest. And just example, a couple of those is accountability, use of technology, collaboration, quick and efficient turnaround, and resource stewardship. So they measure you against your previous application, and if there's no growth, you don't move in position. In fact, you fall off the 100 fleets. So it's really exciting to see and challenge the staff to do better every year. And it doesn't have to be in all 12 criteria. We're kind of big on filling out the entire application because we want to hit every topic if we can. That just shows growth. And even if it's incremental, I'm happy with that. Our first year was ranked 58, which really surprised me. It was kind of our Super Bowl moment. But this year we came in at 75, but there's also more fleets that participate each year. And it's really interesting to measure yourself against other fleets in the industry because there's a lot of big government, a lot of universities, big fleets. So your takeaway from all of those competitions is something that you can incorporate in your own fleet. And that's really what it's all about, is just making each other better. So it's really an honor to be considered one of the top 100s, and other fleets are looking to emulate what we're doing here.
One of the areas we focused on over the past couple of years in conjunction with our larger service organizations inside the PUD is critical asset availability. We know that when we have an emergency, whether it's they need a crane at the hydros, or they need the line trucks, or the big transmission line trucks, that we have critical assets available at the moment they're needed. So it's something we started tracking about 2 years ago was critical asset availability, and it's a target for us every month to bring that number up every month. And we do that through various ways. One of the ways is how we manage the operation in terms of when we work on vehicles. So we operate a swing shift, and we're moving more and more of the critical asset maintenance to the evenings when the assets are not needed. So when the crews come in the morning, they've got that thing ready to go. So if they report something when they end their shift, we can work on it through the night, and it's ready first thing in the morning. And so those are the type of things we learn how to meet our customers' needs, and that's really what this is all about. So
we've got a pretty nice little certificate here.
That's cool.
And we also have some banners that are put up in the shops just to represent the pride in what we're doing here and keep the guys motivated and going. So eventually the goal is to have the wall peppered with those year over year. But tell the guys, just because we go backwards, it's not a bad thing. It's still in the top 100. It's just more competition coming our way. We just got to do that much better.
Yeah. Very good.
I love it. Thank you. Yeah, I love the competitiveness of it, and then the result.
And the ongoing.
For our customers, yeah.
The fact that they want to sustain it, that's really powerful.
Yeah. Well, it's national recognition for the district as well, and showing that we're being good stewards of the resources that we have. Mm-hmm. So I really like that piece of it as well.
Yeah.
I got several comments from individuals at Safeway and out in the community, and enjoyed the article and the recognition. And so congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to invite Tracy Hunt up. Got a couple of things to talk about.
Ooh. I've got some good stuff today. Tracy Hunt, Director of External Affairs. Which one should we do first? How about sea lions? Good news on sea lions, or moving to some good news. So a little background. California sea lion population has increased from 30,000 in the 60s to about 300,000 today. Ooh. NOAA has estimated that about 45% of the spring Chinook disappear between the mouth of the Columbia and Bonneville Dam. Kind of some interesting numbers. So some recent events. Back in March 2015, the three PUDs sent a letter of support for making some changes to how sea lions are managed. 2017, fast forward a little bit, Oregon State University published a new report showing up to 60 million fish may have been consumed by sea lions in 2015. That's five times what it was 5 years ago. So we continue promoting and talking to folks. The PUD Association sent several letters. And Then in June of 2018, Senator Cantwell and Senator Risch introduced a sea lion bill to allow the taking of sea lions on the Columbia River and its tributaries to protect endangered and threatened species of salmon and other non-listed fish species. So that now is running in parallel with movement in the House. So we have two bills that are moving. We sent another PUD letter in support of this. And in August 1st, the Senate bill passed out of the Committee of Commerce, Science, and Transportation. So getting some good movement. And this is, by the way, the first time that there has been a companion bill, both the House and the Senate, on sea lions. So what does it do? You know, this is important to us. Obviously, our fish run through the buffet down there.
Yeah.
And we want to see what we can do to contribute to protecting them. So it does three things. One is the process now is to take a sea lion. You actually have to witness that specific sea lion participating in the buffet line, and then they can take action. So it's individually identifiable and have a significant negative impact. So under the new bill, sea lions are assumed to meet both of these standards if they're in those locations. So that's a good step. Second thing, the tribes are now one of the eligible entities. If once they're trained, they are able to go in and participate in the taking of these. And then finally, this is, we'll have to see where this goes, but the current lethal removal limit is 92 sea lions per year. And because of the process, about 50 are taken. There are probably some other contributing factors, but and this bill changes that 92 sea lions to 100 sea lions. So in effect, what we're doing, it's a step in the right direction. It's a step in the right direction to move away from the individually identifiable. It's a step in the right direction to get some more action going and to test and see what happens. So it's leading towards a more science-based opportunity to eventually get to where we have a better understanding of what's the right number of sea lions and what's the trade-off. So it's not all the way there. Granted, it's a step.
You said the estimated sea lion population has gone from 30,000 to 300,000 on the West Coast in the last X number of years. Mm-hmm. What's the estimated sea lion population on the Columbia River?
I don't have that number on the Columbia.
I'd really be curious to know what 100 means.
Yeah. I'll find out.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Second part is...
Yeah, interesting. Oh, sorry. It's just data. But a sea lion eats 5 to 8% of its body weight a day in fish. So
you're going to ask how heavy the sea lion is?
Well, those are pretty good-sized animals.
Yeah.
There's 300,000 of them. That's immense tonnage.
Yeah. It really is a big number. And as those numbers increase from the 30,000 to 300,000, what are the implications to the various species? I mean, between, you know, so it's not just the sea lions. Obviously, up here, we have the avian predation, and we have the pike minnow. So there's a lot of predators these adult and juvenile fish have to get through. Just one of the components.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you for indulging me in that.
Yeah. So, second part, again, natural resource related, but this one is even maybe a little more positive. In the prior administration back in 2016, the administration proposed some policies that we looked at and thought we were going to have some negative impacts on our HCPs. So we dug into it a little bit. And quick background, HCPs are very unique. We voluntarily agreed to go above and beyond the minimum ESA requirements. And in return, we're able to choose how to meet those standards. So we have a surface collector, and we have notch spill, and we have fish-friendly turbines. And as a result of that, that increase in fish survival, we were able to reduce spill and create more power with the same amount of water. And that action led to what we now refer to as incremental hydropower. Incremental hydropower is really important not only for us, but for others on the federal system, to satisfy things like 937. So this new policy would have made actions previously defined as above and beyond as merely required. So that could have implications not only on what we've done in the past, but also moving forward with Rock Island relicensing, the definition of incremental hydropower and how it's used in carbon markets and other things. So you never know exactly how it's going to unfold, but we saw that as something important. We filed comments in 2016, and again when the policy was under review, and we just found out that the Trump administration has withdrawn the policies and reinstates the policies that were previously in place. So, as you might imagine, there's a lady in my group, Suzanne Grissel, who does a great job on a lot of different things, and one of them was this subject, making sure that she communicated the issue, coordinated with other folks on this issue, and I think this is one where we did make a difference on a national policy that maybe a lot of folks won't ever see, but obviously we will, and we're really proud of what Suzanne did and the work she did around this whole subject. So those are the two issues I wanted to get in front of you today, sea lions and this ESA mitigation policy withdrawal.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Only other manager item is I'll just note that we did get a request last week, testified before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee tomorrow on cryptocurrency mining. It was not going to be possible to do this hearing and that hearing, so declined that request, but was asked to provide written testimony, and that was submitted on Friday. The commissioner should have that. In
there. Good testimony. Yeah, it was very good.
Yes, very good. Thank you. Very informative.
Yep. And I think that's it.
Okay, commissioner items? Anything from the commissioners?
Commissioners, I have one thing, if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
It's my failure for not having it on the agenda, but in your package, you should have a memo. So this is on the charge-offs of uncollectible accounts.
Oh, correct.
So we have a requirement here based upon board resolution to report to the board, and we have historically done so as part of the consent agenda on charge-offs over $1,000. And when Rebecca came on as the clerk of the board, we noticed recently that we had a gap in the knowledge transfer between the former clerk of the board and the current clerk of the board, and those have not been showing up for the last five quarters. Is it quarters or it's months? They don't come every month. So there are 5 months that those did not come to the board and should have, and then they are approved as part of your approval of the consent agenda. So taking the opportunity to learn here, we actually have changed our process. I shouldn't take any credit for it. Rebecca and those that handle this have changed the process to ensure that the clerk gets copies of the charge-off approvals, which John Stoll, I think Kelly, although I may not be, she's nodding no, also see and approve before they go to Steve for his approval as well. So she will get copies of that, and then she's made a change to the clerk of the board's desk manual to make sure that that is a process that's noted in there. So hopefully we won't miss it again. So my apologies for not having that on there. I didn't catch it. But I do have, again, Rebecca has prepared a motion for you at the bottom of the memo that would approve those months that have not been approved. And then going forward, we shouldn't have that same omission.
So does the motion need to be read in its entirety?
If you wouldn't mind, because it doesn't appear on the agenda, Commissioner, I'm sorry about that.
So I would move to approve the charge-offs to uncollectible accounts over $1,000 for April 2017 in the amount of $4,706.88, July 2017 in the amount of $3,280.31, November 2017 in the amount of $7,635.16, February 2018 in the amount of $3,172.46, June 2018 in the amount of $9,819.27.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the charge-offs
uncollectible for April, July, November, February, and June as presented in memo format. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Aye. Motion carries.
Thank you, commissioners.
And that's it for us.
Okay.
I do have one commission
item
that I just want to do an update on. I want to thank Rebecca and the technology team for their ongoing work. We're working on paperless boardroom technology for board members, efficiency, et cetera, and the committee, the group's doing a great job. I've learned a tremendous amount. I went into it with some goals that were very small, and the benefits I'm seeing are really very beneficial and kind of exciting. So that work is moving forward. Rebecca's leadership there, and I think by the end of the year we'll have some recommendations and move forward with that, and I'm really pleased with that. So.
Very good. So I think I checked off 17 earlier, and I think it should have been 16 because I think we did the follow-up on delegation of action items from the previous board. So we would be at delegation of action items from today.
Okay, I've got two items. We're going to resurrect the fire risk analysis presentation and send that to all the commissioners from about a year ago, I think it was. And we are going to look up the estimated sea lion population on the Columbia.
Well, so I actually have been doing that for a while because it was an intriguing request. The estimates I have now are about 3,000 that regularly inhabit the Columbia River from the Bonneville Dam down to the coast, and they refer to it as the Bonneville Buffet. I'm very serious. Can't make that up. Oh,
we deliver. Yeah. Okay. Any other items?
So you can check that one off your list.
Okay.
There you go. Well done. Okay, additional public comment? Apparently not. Any other matters of general business as may necessarily come to the commission? Hearing none, we need to move into executive session, and that would be for approximately...
Say 60 minutes, but I think we're going to do it in less, but just to be sure. But there's an item that you may have questions about.
Okay. We'll take a five-minute break, and then... we'll go into that. So we will move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which a district or its board is likely or is likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I, and to consider the selection of a site for acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when the public knowledge of such consideration would likely would cause the likelihood of the increase in price as authorized by RCW 42.301101B. And we will take a five-minute break and begin approximately a 60-minute session at 2:35. Sullivan County Board of Directors coming back into regular session after an executive session, where no decisions were made, no votes were taken. Any other items come before the commission this afternoon? Hearing none, we are adjourned at 3:06.